Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We are so glad you are here. We're coming to you live from on the eastern side of the mountain where the sun has been shining today. My AccuWindow forecast today, beautiful sunshine. Welcome. The solar wind is up to 368.6 kilometers per second. Sunspot 1049 is quietly making its way across the sun, but poses no threat for solar flares. Solar cycle 24 is now stable, but the sunspots are not the type that solar scientists believe will deliver the kind of conflagration expected by films such as Knowing. Still, you might want to upgrade your brand of sunglasses, and you might want to pick out a nearby abandoned mine for retreat if one becomes imminent. We'll keep you posted, though. Don't worry about it. Double flybys this weekend from Space Shuttle Endeavour and the International Space Station, and now has its functioning observatory. Oh boy, wouldn't that be neat to stand out on that and watch the sun rise 12 times a day. Anyway, tonight Endeavour is going to be heading back to Earth in a rare after dark landing at 10:16 Eastern Standard Time. So we might delay our break a little bit so you can go outside and look at it. If you're in the southern part of the United States, you might see it coming. It's going to come in from the south, so you might not be able to see it unless you catch a horizon view of it. There were a paltry 15 earthquakes in the past 24 hours, and none were over 5.0. The entire planet Earth seems to be at rest this night. This in the wake of every state in the nation, except Hawaii, having the presence of snow. Kind of interesting in the last few days. Some of you have been exposed to the anti-global warming propaganda lately. Reports of an exiled Al Gore and others who gained politically from the theory of climate change are greatly exaggerated, however. While we in the Northern Hemisphere have been covered in white, the Southern Hemisphere is suffering through record heat. Adding up all the temperatures, we see that we are not experiencing global cooling. Remember, there are other energies coming to the planets of our solar system right now. Don't throw away your food storage just yet. As spring approaches, millions more are out of work than ever before. Areas that were left all but untouched during the Depression of 1929 are suffering an almost irreversible loss of value. Unless the Departments of Energy, Agriculture, and Treasury do something meaningful soon to get capital into the hands of small businesses in these impoverished areas, we may risk third world states inside our own nation. I implore you to write your congressman and cry foul as the mega corporations like GM and Goldman Sachs drain our tax dollars into their cash drawers. We have often discussed the subject of UFOs on this program. We have also discussed the subject of contact with alien races on this planet, but we have never spoken to a journalist about the phenomenon. Tonight, we are going into the realm of journalism because perhaps we need some perspective with this. Character always plays a factor in movements, whether we're talking about a prophet or a messenger from beyond. Tonight's guest is a researcher and author who might help give us that perspective. Please welcome with me, Nick Redfern. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Hey, Brooks, thanks for having me on.
Oh, this is really great. We had Nick scheduled, a couple of months back, and he had a toothache, I think it was, wasn't it?
It was beyond a toothache. It turned into like a full-blown abscess. I looked like I'd been punched by Mike Tyson or something.
I'm holding my own
jaw. It was a pleasure. It was right after Christmas as well.
Wow. Nothing seems to hunt you down and bother you like a toothache.
Other than raging teeth, a toothache there again.
Well, anyway, we're glad you're here. I have traveled a little bit, and I've been asked to attend a few conferences where UFOs and aliens were the main subject matter. And I think one thing is very true before we begin tonight. When the subject comes up, I'm often asked, do you believe in UFOs? And I have really found this curious, why people equate the phenomenon of UFOs and contact with aliens with belief. I mean, people don't ask me if I believe in chemistry. So how do you explain this kind of, like, hope for solid knowledge about the subject of UFOs?
Well, it's actually a very good question because, unfortunately, and I do say unfortunately, and I mean it, that belief systems do play a large role within the UFO subject. And my view, and I suppose this comes from more of having a background in journalism, if people ask me if I believe in UFOs, it's not so much a belief, it's more an evaluation of how much evidence there is to support the idea that UFOs exist or don't exist. And my view is that having studied the subject for 20 years thereabouts, and having dug deeply into the way in which government agencies have looked at it, and looking at witness testimony as well, collectively, I think there's sufficient evidence to suggest there's a real UFO phenomenon. So again, you know, there's no need to say I believe or don't believe. It's a matter of equating the evidence versus, you know, the lack of evidence or otherwise.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm convinced there's a genuine phenomenon, but unfortunately, regardless of whether or not, you know, somebody concludes the phenomenon's real or not, belief systems still play a large role. You know, it's like, well, why are the aliens coming here? You know, person number one will say, well, I believe they're friendly. Somebody else will say, I believe they're hostile. What they're basically saying is they don't really know the answer as to why the beings might be here. And so they've come up with a belief system that they've constructed to try and answer the questions that so far we don't have answers to. And unfortunately, that happens in a lot of areas of the unknown where people try and construct a framework without having the hard evidence. It doesn't mean something isn't going on, but it does mean that, you know, we should be wary of trying to construct a framework when we don't have all the answers.
Well, most people don't have a good toolbox, and they don't certainly have journalistic skills or interviewing skills to be able to go out and try to find this evidence. How did you begin in the genre of becoming a UFO researcher?
Well, basically what happened, Brooks, is that my own father was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar, and he was trained with the military, you know, in the field of radar. And he was involved in several incidents where he was based at a particular Royal Air Force base on the south coast of England. And he was involved in several incidents where strange, fast-moving objects were tracked on the radar scopes flying towards the English coast from the direction of Scandinavia. And this was still the Cold War going on at the time. And the first thought was, it's got to be the Russians launching some sort of sneak missile attack. And aircraft were quickly sent up from a nearby Air Force base. The pilots couldn't even get close to these things. They were flying at tremendous speeds and altitudes. And whatever the objects were, they played kind of like a game of cat and mouse with the air crews, to the point where the pilots literally had to return back to base because they were running low on fuel. This occurred over the course of about 3 or 4 nights, and when, after the final night, these things didn't return, everybody who was involved in the incidents in some fashion, whether the radar people, ground crew, pilots, they were all reminded of the fact that they'd signed the military's secrecy oaths and, you know, you won't talk about it to your family, friends, and to the press. And my dad didn't tell me till I was about 14, something like that. And so that got me interested, you know, not because it was my own dad, but also because he had a background in the military. You know, he was trained to recognize what can be picked up on radar and how to interpret it. And when I finished school, I began working on a rock music magazine in England called Zero, and did that for a few years, and also in conjunction with that did freelance work, feature writing for English newspapers like the Daily Express. And I particularly enjoyed, I guess, like investigative feature writing. And then I thought, you know, one day, well, why don't I try and combine the background in investigative journalism with the interest I developed in weird mysteries and so forth, particularly UFOs. And that's basically what started it and sort of set me on this slightly surreal path, I guess.
Yeah, well, slightly surreal. You know, one of the things that sort of gets the room quiet when the testimonies start flying, even at these different conferences and workshops and groups, even when UFO people get together and look at the skies at night, it's when someone brings up the fact that not so much as a bone, a bolt, or a thread of hard evidence on display exists that proves that UFOs are out there. I mean, how did the aspect of contact seem to change the genre from just night sky watching or telling stories of seeing lights in the sky? How did contact seem to change the genre for you?
Well, you know, actually, you know, it's one thing for somebody to say they saw a strange light in the sky, or even a flying saucer-shaped craft in the sky, or somebody in the military tracked it on radar. That's one thing, because, you know, it implies what we perceive a UFO to be, a strange, fast-moving object in the sky that defies explanation. But when you start talking about people who claim to have had literal face-to-face contact and interaction with aliens, then that takes it to a whole new level, if you like, and one that, in many respects, takes it away from the domain of UFOs and literally to direct contact. And I'm sure, you know, most of your listeners, whether they believe it in it or not, I'm sure they've heard of the whole alien abduction scenario, this idea of people being kidnapped and from cars and bedrooms and allegedly transported to an alien craft where they're then subjected to, I guess, like distressing medical experimentation, kind of like a lab rat scenario, by these little aliens that everybody, I guess, is familiar with the large heads and big black eyes, this sort of popular culture image of the aliens. That's very much actually more of like a phenomenon that's been prevalent within the UFO research field for the last 20 or 30 years. But if you go back to the early years, as I did with my Contactees book, back to the late 40s and 50s, the abduction stories weren't really around to any great degree, if barely at all. Back then, you had contact cases where the witnesses claimed to be literally in like face-to-face contact with very human-looking aliens, and actually not in kind of like a lab rat setting. It was almost like a one-to-one meeting of minds. Now, of course, you know, this gets into extremely controversial areas, and as you can probably guess, you know, by the little bit of data I've related so far, that you can probably guess that many of the contactees back then and even today had as many supporters as they did people who were just rolling their eyes, saying, you know, these are just fantasists and cranks, etc. But, you know, as you kind of alluded to at the beginning, the characters and the personalities are kind of what make their stories equally as interesting as the stories, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, I know the subject is sort of a natural progression. You know, you look at craft, you realize somebody's got to be at the wheel of that thing.
Yeah.
And they're certainly acting in an intelligent manner, darting left and right and playing cat and mouse, as you say, with our own aircraft, who really like to enjoy the sovereignty of their own airspace. They don't like something outmaneuvering them like somebody that's never been on ice skates before. But I never really realized that until just this moment. You're right. The aspect of contact, the style of contact, the whole alien abduction kind of viewpoint wasn't really prevalent in the 40s and 50s. It was more take me to your leader, or I'm going to give you a special message to help you spread or at least make some kind of movement that that makes the Earth or its leaders change its mind about its arrangement of weapons and its warlike mentalities. But the thing that I noticed about your book, and I found it, your writing style fascinating, and the way that, even though you didn't actually know these individuals back in the 40s and 50s, the way you collected the information and documented the information made it very credible. I highly recommend the book, by the way. It's called Contactees, A History of Alien-Human Interaction by Nick Redfern. How can they get the book, Nick?
Well, it's available at all good bookstores, Borders, Barnes & Noble, and all good online places like Amazon, etc. And, you know, pretty much anywhere you can get a book, hopefully you'll be able to find it. So.
Excellent. Do you have a website?
Published by New Page Books. It was just published in December.
Do you have a website that you'd like to send people to?
Yeah, sure. My website is nickredfern.com, where people can find all the latest news and things I'm working on and investigations I've been doing, interviews with people. I do a lot of book reviews and things like that, and they're all at the website, and people can find out more about me and the books as well there.
Well, we'll talk about that several times tonight. We just like to get it out early so that people can be buying the book while they're listening to the interview. One of the things that I noticed about your choice of subjects, it was kind of a common theme with them. Almost without exception, they made a public statement, they morphed into some kind of energy guru, and then most of them were busted for cheating people out of money. Why do you think there is this modus of trying to make money from the assertion that they were contacted by aliens?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want people to think that I think that's the case with all the contactees. What I think it is, it's the ones who basically took the wrong path that are the ones everybody talks about because they remember them. You know, the ones who are sort of more down to earth and the stories are less sensational. They don't make as much, you know, they're not as newsworthy, I guess. You know, it's always like that. It's always like the bad penny that kind of comes to the fore, so to speak. Everybody remembers but fails to remember all the other people. But you're quite right. Most of the contactees, where, again, they differ with the abductees today, is that not only did they feel that they were on, like, a mission to spread the word, if you like, in simplistic terms, of the aliens they met about how we should all live in peace and harmony with each other and disarm our nuclear weapons. Rather than just relating that through books, magazine articles, etc., a lot of them felt compelled to set up, I guess, you know, like mind-body-spirit type organizations and cult-type groups and, places where people could come and listen to workshops and things like that, and which, on the one hand, you know, isn't a bad thing, but it's when it crosses the line from doing it for the right reasons to getting into the realm where, you know, it's kind of like taking the pension money of the little old ladies, you know, who come to your meetings every month you need the money to help build a ship to fly to Venus, which, unfortunately, there were people like that in the movement, and, you know, a lot of people were defrauded out of their money. And I think, unfortunately, as I said, I don't want people to think that I'm considering that everybody falls into that category in the contactee movement. I certainly don't. I think it's a minority, but it's the minority, as I said, that gets remembered. But, there are people and there were people like that. And, you know, but then again, you know, you get that. I don't think that's something typical to UFOs. Unfortunately, you get that in all walks of life, you know, whether it's somebody trying to sell a new product or, I don't know, anything, you know, you get con men who take people's money, unfortunately. So.
Oh, yeah.
That says more about human beings, I think, than the contactee movement as such. So.
Yeah, I think the con men are moving up the ladder, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about George Adamski.
Yeah. Well, George Adamski was probably the ultimate contactee. He was, I guess, for people who are interested and know about the UFO subject, he was the one person back then and even now more associated with the contactee movement than probably anybody else. And he was born in 1891 in Poland and moved with his family when he was still a young boy to the US and ultimately settled in Los Angeles. And in the 1930s, he set up an organization called the Royal Order of Tibet, which essentially was kind of like an alternative retreat type thing. Again, like a mind-body-spirit organization of the type that, you know, today people would look twice at it. But, you know, in the 1930s, in a city like Los Angeles, people did look twice. You know, it wasn't the sort of thing you would see every day. So, in other words, this was long before his UFO experiences allegedly began, but he was someone who seemed to be already primed for involvement in, I guess, like esoteric backgrounds and work and, you know, workshops and that sort of thing. But his UFO story really kicked off in the late 1940s when he claimed a number of sightings of large UFOs over the California desert. But it all really came to its sort of fulfillment in 1952 when he, with a number of friends, traveled out to the deserts of California a few hours outside of Los Angeles. And again, he said, like a lot of the contactees, he didn't really know why he felt compelled to go to this one particular part of the desert, only that he felt driven that this is where he should go. And so they went out there and had a little picnic, so to speak, in the desert sun. And he said that as they were doing this, this flying saucer, like a typical 1950s flying saucer type craft, came down and he walked towards it, and this being, a very human-looking being, wearing what was described as something like a ski suit, like a one-piece ski suit, and with a head of long blonde hair, came out of the craft, and he claimed there was like a telepathic exchange where the aliens basically said, in summary terms, that now we've developed atomic weaponry and we're on the verge of venturing into outer space. The aliens had decided it was time to kind of rein us in and warn us, you know, if we're going to go out there, we don't need to take our warlike ways with us. And Adamski, you know, up until that time, he wasn't really anybody well known at all. But shortly after this experience occurred, he co-wrote a book with an Irishman named Desmond Leslie. The book was called Flying Saucers Have Landed. And it told the story of Adamski's encounters up until the time the book was published in 1953, all of which was centered around the sort of face-to-face encounters with aliens and, you know, these sort of philosophical discussions. And Adamski's book with Desmond Leslie, in its first printing, sold just over 125,000 copies, which is sort of an extraordinary number of books to sell, you know, a UFO book. Even today's UFO books don't come anywhere near those sorts of figures. But Adamski's did, and he was literally propelled almost overnight from being, you know, just a guy who actually ran a restaurant in California to someone who became a major player, not just in the UFO scene, but actually, I guess, in the beginnings of developing a cult-type following. And he actually also got watched quite closely by the FBI because he was saying things about these aliens which suggested they had almost like a socialist type of government. So it wasn't surprising that, you know, even people like J. Edgar Hoover were interested in him.
Sure, yeah, I can see where they're talking about a superior race that can, you know, fly our airspace with impunity. I think in the 40s we were still flying propeller-driven aircraft.
Mm.
And even in the early 50s, we were just, you know, just barely talking about supersonic flight.
Yep.
And also that these aliens are evidently talking about a form of government other than truth, justice, and the American way, both of which were of high interest to those who seem to run the intelligence community with an open degree of paranoia. Now, at least their paranoia is somewhat clandestine, but it was rather open in those days. And you're right. I mean, in those days, there really wasn't a full-blown spaceman genre out there. You couldn't. I don't even think you'd go find comic books about Foo Fighters or things like that from World War II. It was just a budding kind of genre in those days. Mm. And to write a book and have it sell like that leads me to believe that perhaps the consciousness of the people was already prepared to receive an idea like that. And Adamski was evidently sounded like the right kind of contactee and wrote like the right kind of contactee and was just foreign enough to the United States. I'm sure if he was born in Poland, he spoke with a little bit of an accent. Yeah. Did he have access to radio? I mean, did he have access to mass media? Was he able to reach people that way? And
well, you know, it's interesting that what he did, I mean, obviously, you know, there was no internet back then, but he did do a lot of radio, and he did travel widely on the lecture circuit. Now, bear in mind, in 53, when his book was published, This was only 6 years after Kenneth Arnold's sighting, which gave birth to the term flying saucer. You know, the subject wasn't really spoken about to any great extent before that, even though people had seen weird things in the sky, like the Foo Fighters in the Second World War. But there wasn't like a cultural phenomenon prior to 47. So it was only a couple of years, really, after that, that his experiences began and wrote his book. But what he did, he extensively traveled the United States, giving lectures to the UFO groups that existed at the time. And, of course, you know, every little newspaper in the towns that he visited, if there wasn't much going on, you know, it would be a big thing in the town. This man who claims to have met aliens is coming to town. So in that respect, he got a lot of publicity. And living in Los Angeles, of course, you know, the big newspapers in the city itself began to cover him also. And, of course, you know, just somebody who, from a human interest story in the newspaper, somebody who worked in a restaurant and then had this organization, the Royal Order of Tibet, and then he's thrust onto the public stage selling 125,000 books. People were like, well, who is this man? What's he saying? You know, it was a good journalistic story. So a lot of that really helped him along. And I think primarily that's one of the reasons why he was watched by the FBI. You know, it's like if me and you were to sit in a room tonight and had a discussion and I said, oh, I've met aliens and they're communists. No one's going to care. No one's going to know. But if you're going on the lecture circuit telling 125,000 of your devoted fans how wonderful communism is, and it's so it's wonderful because the aliens told me it's wonderful, then regardless of whether the story is true, people in the intelligence world are going to sit up and take notice, and that's exactly what they did with Adamski, to the point where he's officially listed in his FBI file, which has now been declassified under the Freedom of Information Act. He's actually described as being a security matter, and that's purely and simply because the FBI, regardless of how they felt about his UFO stories, their concern was, is this man talking about UFOs but actually trying to promote communism and do it under the radar of a UFO movement so he won't get singled out?
So even though there was no official endorsement that the man had actually made contact with any off-planet race, they decided to stick close to him anyway because he was maybe using the glory and the high, shall we say, superior technology of an off-world race to endorse a form of government that our government was adamantly opposed to.
Yeah, that's correct. And bear in mind, this was the early 50s with the whole, you know, McCarthyism, Reds Under the Beds type thing going on. And for anyone, it wouldn't be the greatest thing to say. And, of course, when you then equate this with aliens coming down who are trying to change our way of life and mold us more to their way of life, then it makes sense that the FBI would sit up and take notes. And they did, and they actually visited representatives, special agents of the FBI were actually sent out to interview him on a number of occasions. You know, why are you saying this? On whose behalf are you saying it? You know, tell us a little bit more about these claimed encounters. And they put together an extensive file on him, which, you know, anyone can now apply to get through the Freedom of Information Act from the FBI, and they'll quite happily send it to you for like $10 for the photocopying fees or whatever. So, you know, in that respect, it becomes even more surreal. You find this man who claims to have met aliens working in a restaurant is being watched by the FBI for something like 12 years, which is normally, you'd imagine, the sort of time and effort and money and manpower they would spend on watching a member of the Mafia or something like that. You know, not somebody who said he's met aliens from another planet. And yet, that literally is what happened. It is quite literally like one of those truth is stranger than fiction moments.
Yeah, and then I see how he was tempted. In your book, you know, you mentioned that Adamski, while he was maybe elevated in notoriety by at least being interviewed by the FBI, told them, as it said in your book, Adamski had in his possession a machine which could draw flying saucers and airplanes down from the sky. Mm. I'm sure they were really pleased to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, something else. You know, it's like you sit there in front of the FBI and say, oh, you know, there's this machine, this device, which can kind of stall aircraft engines and bring them out of the sky. It's, you know, not probably the brightest thing to tell them, whether it was true or not. And again, you know, they obviously looked into it. There's this guy with communist sympathies, and he's talking about bringing aircraft out of the sky. You know, it's actually no wonder this file wasn't even bigger than it was, or that, you know, it actually wasn't even brought in and vigorously interrogated in the FBI's, you know, secure rooms, etc. I'm sure today he would be.
Did he change his story after that? I mean, once the FBI started, you know, really paying him serious attention?
You know, unfortunately, he didn't. What he did, the FBI, one of the reasons they contacted him or made contact with him was because rumors were going round that Adamski was saying in his lectures that the FBI and the Air Force were endorsing what he was saying, that actually was sympathizing with his story and they wanted him to get it out. And of course, this wasn't true. And so on one occasion, the FBI, I think the second occasion they visited him, they asked him to sign a form or a document that they prepared, which says, I, George Adamski, understand that the FBI does not endorse my work or my lectures, and I was wrong in my statements. And so they got him to sign three copies, one for the Air Force, one for the FBI, and one for him to keep. And what he did, the copy that he kept, he photocopied it and then, like, whited out various sections. So it actually made it look like the FBI were endorsing what he was saying. And he would wave this document at his lectures. And, of course, that got back to the FBI as well. And J. Edgar Hoover kind of flipped his lid at this and said, you know, go out and read this guy the Riot Act. That's literally what it says in the files. It says, you know, read him the Riot Act and make him understand in no uncertain terms that, you know, we won't tolerate all this nonsense and just get him to stop. But I think the FBI also astutely realized that they were kind of in a quandary, because they realized that if they tried to silence him too much, it would look like they were trying to shut someone up for revealing the truth about UFOs. And it would get round on the lecture circuit and within the UFO research community, oh, the FBI are silencing UFO researchers because we're getting too close to the truth. In Adamski's case, unfortunately, it was just that he was inventing stories about the FBI supporting what he was saying. And, you know, I think, like some of the contactees, I think George Adamski may well have had a few initial real experiences, but then he made the fatal mistake that no one should ever do. When the encounters dried up, all his thousands of followers wanted, what's going on with George? What's the latest? And when nothing else happened, I think he made the fatal mistake of embroidering on these stories and making up stories to try and perpetuate it. And I actually think he did it not maliciously. I think he honestly believed that the story that he was telling about the aliens wanting to spread peace and love, I think he honestly believed what he was doing was a good thing, and that to make up a few stories was seen as being acceptable if it brought more people around to the cause, if you see what I mean.
Right. Right.
And I think that's what he did. But then, unfortunately, when he was proven to have hoaxed some things, it backfired. So.
Well, I get a common question out there when stories like this come about and you read about the guys like Adamski who mean well, and maybe they did have an encounter, mm-hmm. and then the encounters either didn't repeat themselves or the aliens themselves didn't come through with the goods. People ask the question, why didn't the aliens begin working with the governments who, even from a casual outside observation, are in charge of things? Why pick these unassuming, sometimes unemployed, and often mentally unstable individuals to build the galactic empire?
Yeah, you could argue that, you know, the aliens weren't always the best people to judge characters, I guess, so to speak. But, no, you're quite right. I mean, a lot of people ask that question, you know, and the definitive question along those lines is, you know, why don't they land on the White House lawn? You know, that's the scenario everybody thinks of. If they're coming here from so many light years away and they want to make contact, the easiest thing would be to show themselves before the world, you know, whether the White House, the Kremlin, Buckingham Palace, you know, somewhere of note where the world's media would sit up and everybody would know within 24 hours. I mean, we can only kind of speculate. One of the things that, you know, that it admittedly is speculation, but I mean, it's true on our world, is that when any technologically advanced society, you know, goes to an inferior technologically advanced society, invariably the inferior one gets absorbed by the more technologically advanced one and loses its cultural identity. You know, you look at, for example, when the English went to Australia and the settlers there, you know, built up Australia, how the aboriginals, the aborigines who lived there, how their society became marginalized. You know, you could argue the same when the settlers came over, you know, with the Native American Indians over here, how their society was kind of pushed to the sidelines. And I sometimes speculate, and again, I admit it is speculation, whether or not, you know, the idea of, you know, if a truly advanced society from elsewhere came down, we would be looking at them to solve all our problems. You know, we would be almost, as I mentioned to people before, we'd almost be like the kids who never leave home, totally reliant on mom and dad till they're 45 or whatever. And, you know, I think of it sometimes like that, that if they came down and we have all these problems on Earth and we became so reliant on them, we would lose our cultural identity or our ability to progress as a species. You know, we would just be always in their wake and in their shadow. And so I wonder if, you know, if aliens really are visiting, that has crossed their mind, the idea that, yes, we'll give them a slight nudge in the right direction, but an overall worldwide revelation and then have them rely on us isn't perhaps the right way for us to proceed and progress as a society, any more than it's, you know, the, sure, the little bird, it isn't healthy for the little bird to stay in the nest, you know, the parents kick it out, so...
Well, I could see that if we're looking at it from a standpoint that, you know, our older brothers are coming in from the Galactic Federation, yeah, and they're going to give us some kind of training or some kind of advanced technology. But there appears to be an equally powerful awareness in the UFO community that perhaps they're visiting Earth or residing on Earth more like watchdogs than they are older brothers. They're kind of making sure we don't blow things up. I see in your book a common theme that one of the first things the aliens say to their contactee is, you better turn around from your nuclear warlike habits or practices, because that's how we lost our planet. And if it comes to it, we'll step in and make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think, you know, if these stories are genuine, of course, what I see personally is kind of like an organization or a body of people that aren't necessarily our enemies, but if things got too hazardous, they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't have two minds, so to speak, about destroying us if it came down to it. You know, they might not want to do that, but they don't have any problem doing it. In that respect, they're not our direct enemies, but they're not necessarily our best friends either. And I do find it interesting that most of the UFO sightings began large scale and the contacts began after we developed atomic weapons in the mid to late 40s. And as we were beginning to develop a great deal more in terms of rocketry, and it wouldn't be very long before we started venturing out into outer space. And I guess, you know, if there's anybody up there watching us down here, then the time they're going to take action is not when all we can do is fight and squabble with each other, but the day when we develop atomic bombs and we can travel to where they come from potentially, then that may well be the time when we're more likely to see visitation. And of course, you know, it's a fact that the quicker a society develops, you know, it almost goes at like an exponential rate where, you know, what took 10 years, next time, the next development takes 5 and 2.5 and 1, et cetera, et cetera. And there's like this real peak where we go from 100 years ago from barely having manned flight with the Wright brothers till today where we can send probes out to Mars, you know, and it goes so fast. So I do wonder if that's one of the reasons, almost like they're watchdogs, so to speak, watching us to see how we develop, and if we destroy the planet before we can leave it, well, that's our tough luck.
Yeah.
If we start heading out into their realms, that's a different story. So.
It does seem that the technology almost outstrips our wisdom to use it. I mean, you're right. I mean, in 60 years, we've gone from carbureted tanks to satellites watching every square centimeter of the enemy's ground to monitor things, and we're able to travel even outside the heliosphere with probes now and look outside our solar system and the influences of our own sun. That being said, The fact is, at least from most of the UFO community that wants to admit it, that the aliens have chosen thousands of years worth of thousands of contacts in remote areas, like the desert or the high mountains, to make their contacts. It doesn't seem that they're even watching the missile engineers to grab them on their way home on the remote mountain road. You know, they're stopping people like Betty and Barney Hill. They're stopping George Adamski. They're visiting people who exist more or less in ignominy, and they're making tremendous revelations to them, and then ostensibly expecting them to go out to the world and try to change things. It seems like an almost insurmountable mission for the aliens and for the contactees.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, arguably the aliens could change things overnight. If they exist, of course, they could change things overnight by making the classic landing, you know, on the White House lawn or whatever. But the fact that they don't, you know, is some like a kind of a kick in the teeth from their perspective, because really you could argue quite strongly that just contacting 20 or 30 contactees, et cetera, and having them do it, really, yeah, 125,000 people is a lot. But it's nowhere near, you know, the literally billions who you could convince overnight if you did a massive landing all across the planet. You know, again, but I sometimes wonder if, you know, some people think that the UFO presence is a huge one, that there are, you know, millions of them coming here, etc. I sometimes wonder, you know, if they're actually, although they're obviously in advance of us, maybe they're only more than a couple of centuries ahead of us, to where perhaps there aren't that many of them coming here. And if that's the case, that perhaps they don't, you know, the imagery that they're all powerful and et cetera, maybe a little bit of a ruse. Perhaps they have, you know, who knows, a handful of craft which they fly here, there and everywhere to make it look like, you know, they're all powerful. But if you imagine if there was just, you know, a couple of hundred of them coming here, and so they're kind of trying to infiltrate and society, when actually if they would land to land en masse, so to speak, they'd be overwhelmed because we outnumber them. Perhaps they want to try and create the image, you know, that they're all powerful and there's far more of them than us. That might not be the case. You know, there could be just like an armada that have visited us and are trying to change us from the inside, and the best way for them to do it, because they're outnumbered, is to try and stay in the shadows.
Right. That'd be like Columbus coming aboard the shore in a hovercraft. Even though he only has three, he's slightly outnumbered, so he better just kind of scoot in and scoot out and make it look like he's
exactly, but possibly make it look like he's got far more than he has.
Right. Wow, that's interesting. That's an interesting take. One of the things that that I like about your book is the way you go into depth with the interviews of the contactees, at least the evidence that's available. You give us the whole story, the whole picture. And very soon in the book, you bring into the picture the idea that government did give some thought to what's going to happen to society if they make a mass approach, if they make a mass flyover over Washington. What's going to happen? How are people going to react? And so evidently it appears that the CIA gets involved very early in the genre and starts doing some experiments, some playing around. Tell us about Mr. Angelucci.
Orfeo Angelucci was one of the, again, one of the earliest contactees, and he had an interesting story. He, as a child, he was sort of a very sickly, ill child, suffering from a lot of ill health right through his teens and 20s. And he developed an interest in like rocketry and flight and things like this, and he was fascinated by experiments with balloons, like high altitude experiments, and he said that one particular day in the late 40s he launched this large cluster of balloons, and he said as he was watching it fly in the sky, this saucer shaped object swooped in as if it was wondering what this balloon cluster was. It was almost like monitoring it. And after that, he claimed to have heard like this disembodied voice saying that, you know, some sort of extraterrestrial intelligence wanted to make contact with him. And all his contacts, he said, occurred at like a remote, very dark, isolated bridge outside of Los Angeles where he would travel to late at night and park the car and then go under the bridge. And he actually talked about how these experiences would begin, not with like the landing of a flying saucer, but he said he would see these kind of like balls of glowing light, which would almost like hypnotize him. And then the lights would transform into almost like an angelic looking alien being, where they would have an exchange which is very similar and typical of George Adamski, like, you know, the nuclear weapons angle, living in peace and harmony, etc. Now, that was his initial set of experiences, which he wrote about in a couple of books. What was interesting, though, is that there's evidence that at least some of Angelucci's experiences, they sound very much like, I don't know if you ever heard of the early CIA project MKUltra. MKUltra was essentially, in simplistic terms, a mind control project. It was a project the CIA set up to use to do early investigations into things like LSD to see if they could, you know, drug enemy agents and get secrets out of them by putting their minds into an altered state. And of course, LSD was pretty much first synthesized in 1948. So it was in the early years after this that the CIA began looking at all sort of hypnotism, altering people's minds, and again, to see if it could be used from an espionage perspective. And Angelucci, in one of his books, talks about an experience where he met this, or claimed to have met this guy, who said he'd met similar aliens to those that Angelucci had met. And they met in a restaurant, and the guy said to Angelucci, well, I can tell you about these experiences, but you have to drink this liquid. And so he gave him a glass of liquid and put this pill in it, which, you know, kind of reckless to go ahead and drink something when somebody's put a pill in a drink and then told you to drink it. But Angelucci did do this, and he said that within about 30 minutes, his mind felt kind of strange, and the room kind of took on different colors and tones, and he saw all sorts of fantastic swirling figures, and it literally did sound like an LSD experience. And to make it even more interesting, he said at two tables away from where he was sitting, there were two military guys in uniform staring intently at him, as if it was almost like some experiment that they were trying to gauge how successful it was. And the guy who said he'd had these similar UFO experiences began questioning him all about his own encounters. It was almost like they'd rendered Angelucci into like a bit of a drugged altered state to try and get the truth out of him, using truth drugs, I guess, about his experience. And, you know, again, it sounds fantastic, but there's no doubt that the CIA were doing a lot of dabbling and digging into mind control and mind manipulation in this period. And it does sound like a classic drug trip that he was put on as a means to kind of open his mind and for the CIA to find out what he was doing and why he was doing it, and in a way where he probably afterwards wouldn't remember too much about it.
So, do you think that they were experimenting with him in the sense that they wanted to see what the drug would do, or do you think that they were trying to... because evidently they knew a little bit about him. Evidently, he reports that they spoke to him about his balloon experiment, that they've been watching him. And, you know, this is a frail guy, you know, just a pretty alone kind of guy, not the kind of guy that is a leader of people. And yet he reports this amazing experience where they are paying serious attention to him and they're involving him in an experiment. Do you think maybe that they wanted to know what level of panic society would display if they were exposed to this? Or do you think there was a disinformation effort going on here?
Well, I think there's actually several things, Brooks. I do think that there have been a number of very, very credible UFO incidents. And there's no doubt, if you look at the CIA's declassified files from the early 50s, they actually expressed a lot of concern as to what the nature of the UFO phenomenon was and how it could, from like a sociological perspective, affect the people. And of course, they were also looking at it, well, if it affects the people sociologically, how is it going to affect people psychologically? And from a national security perspective, are people going to be jamming the emergency lines, you know, with phone calls? And are the Russians going to take advantage, you know, if no one can get through on the emergency signals? Could they launch a sneak attack, you know, behind a UFO scare?
So there were
all these different angles the CIA was looking at. And I think, as I sort of express in the book, the possibility that the CIA may actually have staged some UFO incidents, and to have done so, not to fool people as such, but to put certain people in the place of experiencing these incidents and then seeing how they respond and react to them. And then if the CIA was stage managing the experience, it would allow them to gauge how effective and or how the incident or the event changes the person. And that would give them a good idea of how it might also affect people on a worldwide level if there were genuine incidents. So it was almost like staging an incident to gauge the reaction of the population or a single person before the aliens actually land, you know, give them a sort of preemptive understanding of what might occur. But also, I mean, you look at people like Angelucci, there were a lot of rumors surrounding him that, you know, was he being encouraged to spread like communist and socialist ideas? And I also think the CIA had concerns about that, and they watched the contactees for that reason. You know, were they kind of like undercover Soviet moles or something, trying to spread communism again under the, like a UFO motif? So I think there's probably several things going on with the CIA, and unfortunately, you know, 60 years later, I'm not sure we'll ever fully get the, you know, the complete picture.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, if you look back on it, you look at the way great leaders like, say, Constantine took over the state. Obviously, didn't have a strong enough army, didn't have a good enough governmental philosophy, was rather, you know, self-centered, didn't really have a theme to guide his people. But Christianity seemed like the dope of the day, and it was really nice to have the threat of eternal damnation to kind of keep people in line. Perhaps there was a new game in town. It was the new alien game, and maybe if the aliens, you know, could gain at least a national or international belief system that if you don't do this or if you do this, you're going to gain favor of the aliens, and that maybe this was going to replace God or replace the church as the thing to which people put their faith in, and that maybe the whole belief in God might tumble, because obviously if there were other intelligent races on other worlds who, for instance, weren't Christian, that might put a small fly in the ointment, as it were, to keeping people in line. Well, listen, I don't have to listen to you, priest. The aliens are going to take care of everything, and there's going to be no eternal damnation here. I could see where that would be rather upsetting to the status quo.
Yeah, you're quite right. That is one of the things that sort of sets the contactee movement apart from just somebody who said they've seen a UFO, or even largely people who claim to have been abducted. The contactee movement was more like a modern-day religion. And, you know, you can actually draw parallels between a lot of the contactee experiences and an ancient religion, particularly Christianity. For example, you know, George Adamski goes out into the desert, a UFO comes down, and an alien tells him this is how the human race should live. Moses goes up into the mountains and gets the Ten Commandments, which tell people how to live. You know, it both involves a message from higher beings, but instead of, and as with, you know, the story of God and the Ten Commandments, God didn't make some massive showing all around the world. He came down to one man on the mountains and gave him the Ten Commandments, which is very contactee-like, if you see what I mean. It's, you know, right. A higher intelligence, not approaching the world on a worldwide scale, but having one man or two people or whatever going out and spreading the word. And I think there was this concern with the contactee movement that it would mutate into like a modern-day religion where God's demons, heaven and hell, heaven and hell, would be replaced by aliens and this planet and that star system. And again, I think probably, although we can never prove this, I would be very surprised if there weren't studies undertaken that would look, that probably looked into the way in which society, from a religious perspective, could be changed had these contactee cults really grown, you know, on a truly massive scale. And I think there probably was a concern that, okay, we're not going to be able to destroy them or get rid of them because people notice, but we can perhaps try and diffuse the interest to where they become just a quirky little thing in one city or whatever, and they don't, you know, spread here, there, and everywhere.
I like it. Well, that's a good place to take a break. We'll take a quick 4-minute break, and we'll be back with more Nick Redfern right after this. Just take a break, relax a little bit. We'll be back in about 4 minutes. Glad you're with us tonight here on X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern United States, and our AccuWindow forecast is very mild tonight compared to the last 3 weeks. We're glad you're with us. We're talking about a subject tonight, UFOs, alien contact, and the contactees that have formed the genre around which we form or don't form our skepticisms. I can tell you that there's great passion about this subject. It's everywhere. There are believers and non-believers, just like there are in religions and other philosophies. But there's one thing that you can't take out of this. You know, they say when you look out at the night sky, it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're a romantic or a scientist, something out there seems to draw us, seems to get our imaginations going, seems to make us realize that perhaps we are not the center of the universe. Maybe we're not even the center of this planet. Maybe Earth itself, an orb so special and so rare, placed in the blackness of space on the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy, is so incredibly attractive, so amazingly beautiful and special and rare, that we attract visitors from other worlds. Maybe those visitors came long, long ago and have interacted with race after race of humans as they exist on the Earth. Atlanteans, Lemurians, Mayans, even Tibetans speak of contact with beings from other worlds. So we have a journalist with us tonight, Nick Redfern, author of Contact Ease, A History of Alien-Human Interaction. We're going to get into it, and we're going to invite your phone calls. The phone number, if you want to call in tonight and be part of the program, is 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you. The website, if you're listening live, you can always go to your computer, go to nickredfern.com. You'll get a little bit more information about the book, where Nick might be speaking, and you can pick up the book everywhere where good books are sold. Welcome back to the program, Nick.
Thanks, Brooks.
Let's talk the rest of this hour. We'll talk about some more of the contactees as as you really do a great job of journalism in the book. I like the writing style. I actually read it twice, and then I wrote a bunch of notes in the margin because I'm going to use it as a reference book for a long time to come.
No, thank you.
Let's talk about Mr. Carr. There was perhaps maybe... If we start here, we can go up from here. But this guy really had a lot going on in the UFO genre. He kind of joined the UFO bandwagon, as it were.
Yeah, this is a man named Otis T. Carr, and unfortunately, you know, he was one of these people who really sort of literally did jump on the bandwagon of the UFO movement. He was unfortunately one of these people who saw, I guess, the potential, at least dollar value, of being in the UFO field. And most of the people who were the contactees in the 50s, you know, unlike the abductees today, where a lot of people talk about abductions beginning as children, a lot of the contactees were sort of in their 40s and 50s when they claimed these experiences began. And certainly Otis T. Carr was one of these people, and, you know, he claimed this... you know, like a typical contactee scenario, without going over all ground, you know, the typical classic scenario. But his angle on it was not to sort of go and spread the ufological word as such, but he got more involved, initially at least, in the whole aspect of alien technology and advanced technologies. And this is like a curious thing we see running through a lot of the contactee stories and people, is that they seem to develop this fascination with highly advanced technology and almost to the point of obsession with trying to build weird and wonderful devices and things like this, free energy devices and that sort of thing, almost as if somebody has implanted the idea in their brain that, you know, you need to kind of think outside the box and come up with new technologies, etc. And certainly that's what Otis T. Carr did. He had kind of, as I point out in the book, this sort of used car salesman approach of looking everywhere and everywhere for an extra penny or an extra dollar and trying to encourage people why it was important that they fund these projects he had to try and build spacecraft to go to the moon, etc. And of course, you know, it was really just a way of fleecing people for their money. All the prototypes he had of these craft were literally nothing more than like wooden and cardboard mock-ups. There was never any sort of, you know, complete device or anything like that that even had a chance of getting off the ground, never mind getting to the moon and back. But of course, you know, such was the lure, almost like the hypnotic lure of the contactee movement, that you had what I call the little old lady brigade, etc., who, you know, were willing to give him a certain large percentages sometimes of their life savings because dear old Mr. Carr was, you know, said it would be good to help him get to the moon. And unfortunately, you know, again, he was one of the people who was one of the wrong people in the movement, but who gets remembered purely because of what he did. And, you know, he ended up as some of these people did, you know, in trouble with the law because of what he did and what he'd done and paid the price. But, unfortunately, you know, it is people like this, even though I believe there could be a genuine phenomenon going on with the contactees, you know, it inevitably gets blighted when you have people like this who are just in it for the wrong reason, but they get remembered because they were in it for the wrong reasons. So.
Well, you know, there is some merit to this because I'm going to bring a couple things in here that perhaps might add a dimension to this. One is when I went to Tibet a number of years back and managed to get behind a door that had been, I guess, chained since the late 50s, and I took a photograph of a structure that the Tibetans called a stupa. And the amazing thing about this structure is it had this sort of cocoon-like structure in which the body of a Panchen Lama, or a likeness of a body of a Panchen Lama, was placed with this rainbow energy coming out from behind his head. And it was lined with sapphires. Now, in electronics world and rocketry world, we know sapphires have amazing properties, that of particular resonant frequencies that can be held, and also a lack of friction because the molecules of sapphire are so smooth. They don't even need bearings. Sapphire bearings are used sometimes in very small machines. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing that I found was, because I have a background in physics, that the darn thing looked like a Tesla coil. Huh. And when I did some research on Nikola Tesla, I found that he reports in his own writings that he got the idea for the coil from dream states in which it seems, shall we call them off-world, influences came to him with designs. Now, it looks like the Tibetans in the 6th century and Tesla in the 19th century got the same idea, but Tesla had the skill set to put it together. And he also had the support of wealthy men like Edison and Morgan and Westinghouse to actually build the darn things, and they worked. Now, yeah. If, you know, you got all the naysayers, you got all the people that try to build it out of wooden cardboard because they aren't physicists, they don't have the background in electronics and physical theory, but you do have the guys that do have the background in that, and they're getting the same ideas, and they're building them. Now, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to take away from the notion that when people, you know, try and build these things, that they're all common. I don't believe that at all. And, you know, it may be the case that Otis T. Carr did have a real experience, but the problem was, you know, he capitalized on it in the wrong way because he couldn't do it the right way. You know, he didn't have the technology and the funding. So he went down the wrong path. But you're quite right that there are a lot of people throughout history who have claimed, you know, that with science, technology, etc., or just, you know, transformative religions and things like this, the experience began in kind of like an altered state, a dream state, and then they were sent on this almost like an obsessed mission to, you know, to come up with an unusual idea, a life-changing idea, if you like. And, you know, you have to wonder if this dream state isn't just something internal to them, that there was something external getting into their minds and pushing them down that particular pathway.
Wow. Exactly right. And maybe you get the idea that when this intelligence puts its thought out there. It's picked up by people who are resonating with that particular thought. Some people just say, wake up from it and go, wow, that was an amazing dream. Mm-hmm. Others wake up and say, hey, there's money to be made here.
Yeah.
And others wake up and say, hey, I know how to build that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, I guess people want a black and white answer. The problem is, you know, the human beings are complex animals, and I think, you know, that's one of the things we always need to remember. You know, there aren't UFO researchers and then there's human beings. We're all human beings. And so the UFO movement is made up of complex people because the human race is complex. So, again, you know, this leads to all sorts of ideas and reasons why people do whatever they do in the UFO field, in as much as why somebody becomes a priest or somebody robs banks. You know, it's just human beings. That's all it comes down to, I think. So.
Right, right. Well, tell us a little about Greg Bishop. He had a story to tell as well.
Yeah, Greg's a good friend of mine, and Greg has delved deeply into the contactee movement for a number of years. And, you know, like me, he came initially from the perspective that, you know, it's all nuts and bolts, aliens, etc. But over time, he began to see how the phenomenon over the years seemed to have changed. And, you know, seems to have, I guess, developed as we've developed. You know, it seems to mirror our society in many ways. And Greg takes the view that possibly these UFO entities or intelligences, you know, the ones that today we people see as the little bug-eyed grey creatures, or the more human-looking ones in the 50s, or going back 500 years, stories of goblins and pixies, etc., and 2,000, 3,000 years ago of demons, things like that. He wonders if they could all be part of one phenomenon that is trying to get a message across, but it has the literal ability to manipulate the human mind to where we see it in like a fashion that is acceptable and culturally acceptable to the people of the day. So whereas today, you know, people wouldn't believe in pixies or fairies appearing before them, they would believe in seeing an alien. But it's the message stays the same, you know, whether it's God's whatever, it's the message pretty much remains unaltered, but it's the medium through which the message is delivered that is kind of upgraded, you know, like a computer program every so few centuries when the people's perceptions and belief systems alter. And so Greg kind of views it as almost UFO experience is almost kind of like a matrix world where we see something and we fully believe what we're seeing, but maybe we're being manipulated and it's what we're seeing is an image rather than how it really looks.
Yeah. There's a whole subset of physics that believes that, well, doesn't really believe it. It has proven that there is some kind of dichotomy between whether we live in a matrix and we're being deceived, or whether what we actually see is the average of the manifestation of all the beings in the set. So if the beings themselves are observing a little bit different kind of reality, reality changes. So one affects the other, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex area of research, and, you know, it's not easy to always get your head around, but I guess it's more, you know, in simplistic terms, it's kind of like hypnotizing people to see something that is there, but we see it in a way different to how it actually looks. And it needs to change as society changes, but its intention is always to try and, you know, get the message out there, so to speak.
But if you
look back a lot of these stories, you know, people say, I don't want people to think I believe there's fairies at the bottom of the garden, because I certainly don't. But, you know, if you look at, say, 500-year-old fairy encounters in England, they very often involve, you know, somebody goes out in the woods and they see the so-called fairy lights come down. Then the next thing they know, they're kind of in like an altered state of mind, and they get taken to the fairy kingdom. They stay there for 2 days and come back only to find that just 2 hours has gone by.
Right.
That's actually not that different from somebody seeing lights in the sky. They get taken on board a UFO and they have missing time. You know, it's kind of like today the aliens supposedly involved in like a genetic experiment where they take DNA, sperm and eggs, etc. 500 years ago, people were taken to the fairy kingdom to mate with the fairy queen to help the fairy race survive, or they would steal babies. You know, again, you have this reproductive obsession that the aliens had have now that fairies had 500 years ago. Again, it's like the motif's changed, but the modus operandi, if you like, is pretty much the same. So
I want to go more into the depth of the orbs of light and stuff like that in the third hour. I find this totally fascinating, and I really find it coming of age, as it were, since the advent of digital photography, and everybody's out there shooting pictures of orbs now. But I definitely want to talk about that in depth in the third hour. I like Greg's work. He contacted a guy named Mr. Shermer, who made a pretty amazing comment that Greg found very fascinating. Mm. What was that comment? I mean, this is really profound.
Yeah. Well, this is a guy named Herbert Shermer, who was a police officer. And, you know, of course, all witnesses, you know, if you've got credible witnesses, you have a great story. But when you have someone like a pilot or a police officer, then, of course, people take note of it much more. Because, you know, somebody in a position of authority and credibility has a lot to lose if they say not only have they seen a UFO, but they've been on board it and spoke with the aliens, which is what Shermer claimed. And he was a police officer who had this experience in a place called Ashland in Nebraska in the 1960s. And essentially his story was that he was on duty in the early hours of the morning and saw what he thought was a truck broken down by the side of the road. So he put his main beams on, and as he got closer, he could see actually wasn't a truck by the side of the road. It was like an oval-shaped object hovering a little bit above the road, like a definitive flying saucer. And he said, according to what he consciously recalled, he said that he sat there and then suddenly the object flew off over the top of his car and was gone. And when he got back to the police station, he wrote something like, saw a UFO, believe it or not. He wrote that in the logbook. But afterwards, like a lot of people who've claimed close encounters, he realized that there was a substantial amount of time that he couldn't account for when he, you know, he'd been on duty and 2 hours seemed to be missing, just couldn't work out where it had gone or whatever the period of time was. So he was subsequently agreed to go under regressive hypnosis. And during the course of hypnosis, this story came out about how something had actually been, I guess, blocked from his conscious mind. And that was that supposedly he'd been taken on board the craft by these sort of 5-foot-tall, very human-looking beings, but obviously smaller than us, and, you know, that you would look definitely twice and probably 3 times at them, you know, if you saw them in the street. But they looked basically human-like. And they reportedly spoke about how they were coming to the Earth. You know, they had concerns that they chose people at random because, you know, this is one of the points you brought up earlier. They chose people at random rather than landing, you know, in front of everybody because they didn't want the government to be able to track them by following a pattern. It was just like a random motivation as to where and who they went to. But one of the aliens supposedly made an interesting comment to Shermer, and that was before he was taken off the craft. One of them said to him, "We want you to believe in us, but not too much," almost as if they wanted us to think they were here, but, you know, maybe don't rely upon them, you know, don't become obsessed with us, don't rely on us for every aspect of your life, but still think, you know, maybe they are there, possibly. It was sort of like an enigmatic statement, but it was almost like, you know, something like that along the lines of, yeah, believe in us, but don't rely on us too much, that sort of thing, so.
Well, the thing that came to my mind when I read that in your book was that, you know, perhaps they've been here for a long time. Maybe they, you know, visited cave people. Maybe they visited early settlers or even aboriginals or indigenous peoples. And in those days, their visitation was seen as divine almost. They worshipped them. They maybe built a complex system of sacrifices for them to keep them pleased. And maybe that's what they had in mind. That's what came to my mind. You know, we want you to believe in us, but you know what? We're not divine beings, so don't worship us. Don't go out there and, you know, form a new cult around us. But it's been nice having you along on the craft.
Yeah, I mean, it could be like that. And again, that kind of goes along with the idea of people not becoming over-reliant on them and overwhelmed by them to where you know, everybody just looks to them for all the answers. You know, it's like, don't just set up some group praising us. You know, they're just the equivalent of the Apollo astronauts or something, nothing more, nothing less.
Do you think maybe that these beings were ancient occupants of Earth, or do you think they were occupants from another world that came here?
That's an interesting theory. I have a chapter in the book which was hypothesized by a friend of mine named Mac Tonis. Mac unfortunately died in October of last year from heart disease, at the age of only 34. But he has a book coming out next month, which is sort of published, obviously, posthumously, called The Crypto-Terrestrials. And Mac's theory was that these beings that, you know, looking so much like us, and the idea of them doing genetic experiments, which actually would work with us, you know, and them, where you would imagine, you know, beings from across the galaxy, they would be so different to us, it would be kind of trying to, like, gene splice between a human and a cockroach or whatever. Matt came up with the idea, which actually isn't a new one, but he kind of really took it to its ultimate degree. The idea that perhaps, you know, if you go back into ancient legends of places like Atlantis and things like that, we hear a lot of stories about how in the distant past there were highly advanced human civilizations that wiped themselves out, you know, in the same way that if we wiped ourselves out today, maybe in 50,000 years, there wouldn't be very much left of our civilization, just a few fragmentary buildings and rubble and things like that. And Matt came up with the theory and advanced it quite deeply that possibly these so-called aliens as we see them may not be alien, but they may be like the final last vestiges of some sort of ancient culture that pretty much destroyed itself and possibly even went underground, you know, into deep caverns and underground installations, and have lived there, hidden from society ever since, only venturing out when we, I guess, potentially cause havoc to the world that they're forced to share with us, you know, i.e. the Earth, and that possibly, you know, their concerns about nuclear war actually would make more sense, you know, if they were forced to share the planet with us. If they're from 10 light years away, you know, even if we developed spaceflight, it would take us probably centuries to get, you know, to the nearest star system before we developed that technology. So why would they be so concerned about what we were doing in the 50s? If they were the last legs of some ancient civilization, maybe it would be more to their advantage to have concerns about atomic warfare, and also to stress every time, you know, they meet with us that they're alien. You know, they specifically just stress that point, oh, we're from this star system or that star system. You know, it's almost like overplaying your hand, so to speak. They do anything to convince people they were extraterrestrial. And Mac hypothesized that maybe they weren't. You know, possibly they were these, you know, before they went extinct or going extinct, they wanted to try and hang on to some semblance of society away from us, but to ensure that we didn't take us with them if, you know, we blew ourselves up. And again, Mac admitted it was a theory and nothing else. But if you read his book when it comes out, he actually has a lot of good arguments that sound quite credible as to why these things might not be alien, but might be, you know, something that secretly coexists with us, but in stealth.
Yeah, and if they were holding on in some kind of, you know, fragile colony.
Yes, that's basically how he describes it, yeah.
You know, maybe they wouldn't want their whereabouts to be known, and so they practice their own disinformation. Yeah. Oh, yes, we're from Venus or we're from Neptune, so that's where you need to be looking for us. And by all means, don't look beneath the Earth or on the bottom of the sea. Mm-hmm. A lot of UFOs come out of the water. They come out of lakes. They come out of big rivers. Yeah. They come out of the ocean. Ocean liners see them. Naval ships see them. Airplanes see them as they come up out of the sea. And when you think about it, what is it, 4/7 of the Earth is water, or 5/7 of the Earth is water. Mm. It's a great place to hide. We have very narrow shipping lanes and not a whole lot of ships on the water anyway. And there are areas of the Earth, for instance, around the Arctic Circle, that have never been sailed by ships. So,
oh, yeah, and, you know, some of the deeper oceans, I mean, military submarines, you know, even they have trouble going to the really, you know, the lower depths of some of the world's oceans. And it would be an ideal place for a highly advanced society that, you know, as you say, is hanging on by a thread, fight its final colonies or whatever. And, you know, Mac also wondered, and again, this kind of makes sense, you know, the idea in abduction stories, people talk about the aliens, you know, abducting us for DNA, sperm, eggs, etc. Mac sort of speculated, well, if this is one last final colony, who's not to say that they haven't become so inbred that they've almost made themselves infertile to the point where now they have to go out and find new blood to ensure their survival, and that new blood is us, and because we're related to them, it actually has a potential for working. You know, that would make more sense than aliens coming from millions and millions of light years away, and it just so happens, coincidentally, we're compatible with them in their gene splicing experiments, which seems a little bit, you know, too coincidental, I think.
Yeah, it really does, and when you're doing investigations like this, and you're putting the facts together, and you're seeing motivations and evidence begin to line up, it's not so outlandish to think that maybe one of these ancient mega races that ended up getting in a terrible war with another mega race ended up wiping out most of the planet on the surface, making it maybe uninhabitable for large numbers of their race. They had to make their way underground, or maybe even, you know, extraplanetary conflagration, meteor storms, killer asteroids, you know, fires, cosmic radiation, all kinds of things that we do see evidence of in the ancient record as we go geologically around our planet. Maybe things weren't too hospitable 25,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago or a million years ago. And they had to go underground, and so
it's kind of like, you know, say for example, hypothetically, there was a third world war tomorrow, or a big catastrophe occurred, you know, like a meteorite or a comet hitting the Earth. You know, there would be the people who, in the military bunkers underground, would survive, and they would probably survive pretty much unchanged. But for the people who lived outside, you know, the survivors, the general public, you know, you imagine that if all electric's gone, we're reduced to living in just rubbles and ruined buildings, the next generation of children that would be born wouldn't have any understanding of television or the internet. They probably wouldn't learn to read too well. And they probably, the language would be kind of stunted as well. And then when their children were born, they probably wouldn't be able to read at all. It would only like take two or three generations before people pretty much went back to very primitive levels. And then, of course, if that coincided with when the people underground started to come out again, you know, it would only take sort of 40, 50 years before the highly technologically advanced people who survived underground came out to be faced with pretty much savages who couldn't read, write, and wondered what all this rubble around them was. You know, just fragmentary rumors of some big disaster in the past, you know, that nobody really understood because they didn't really know what it meant. So, you know, it shows how quickly things like that could happen and how legends could develop about the survivors being these massively, you know, intelligent people who flew these fantastic machines, which might be a few helicopters, you know, that they managed to take underground with them or whatever. So, and, of course, no one would know what a helicopter was after 50 years after a nuclear war or whatever. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my
great-grandfather. It makes sense, and it's an interesting theory, so.
Amazing vehicles. They used to drive at a mile a minute on roads as smooth as glass. Oh, sure, they did. Right.
Yeah, and even if they understood the concept of what a car was, you know, it's, as I said, it would only take a couple of generations before writing and reading was gone. You know, people would be just struggling to survive, not teach their kids to read, probably, because there'd be no controlled society. It would just be everyone for themselves, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, be rubbing two sticks together to make fire.
Yeah, literally.
Well, hopefully we don't end up there. And it seems like some of these icons in the contactee world made contact with the races that were really motivated to keep us from doing that. Tell us about Mr. Billy Meyer. What was his history?
Yeah, Billy Meyer was one of the latter-day, and still is latter-day, contactees. There's no doubt that the contactee movement, in terms of people having these experiences, has gone on pretty much since the late 40s till the present day. We still get contactee cases right now, but they're more, I guess, like under the radar. You know, it's not seen as particularly popular or the in thing within the UFO research movement to talk about contactee cases. They're kind of seen as a little bit of an embarrassment to a lot of people. But Billy Meyer was, although the contactee movement was at its height in the 50s, Billy Meyer was someone who sort of came later in the 60s and then really sort of reached his peak, you know, in the latter day years, sort of late 70s, 80s, 90s. And his cases are very, or reports are very similar to many of the others. He was, or still is, a Swiss man. He was a farmer, and he's most notable for, he's produced a tremendous number of photographs allegedly showing alien craft, you know, in the skies over Switzerland and sometimes at very low level. And his story is pretty much, you know, like many of the others, of having encounters over the years with higher spiritual beings telling him where they're coming from, you know, the nature of their society and government and coming here again for peace-loving spiritual reasons. But as I said, he's really come, I guess, to the fore because of these tremendous amounts of photographs, which, although, you know, a lot of people write them off, the fact is, a lot of them look incredibly good. You know, they don't look like something where somebody just hung something on a piece of string and then photographed it or thrown a plate in the sky and photographed that. They actually look like large structured objects, photographed very well, but showing an incredible scene. And like most of the contactees, Billy Meyer's developed a deep following. You know, there's a huge amount of books devoted to his claims and experiences and reports. You know, developed a huge following just in general. And, you know, this also goes to show that it's a worldwide phenomenon. You know, as I said, he's a Swiss farmer. And so in that respect, you know, it's not just a phenomenon that touched the United States or England. It really has, you know, its roots have gone here, there, and everywhere. And he's one of the few, I won't say original contactees, but certainly the second wave of contactees who's still alive and active, and, you know, a lot of websites devoted to what he's doing. And it shows in that respect, the contactee movement, in terms of developing deep followings and supporters, you know, that's exactly the same. That hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, I think I haven't really researched it that deeply. We had Michael Horn on the program, and we've you know, looked at some of his video work and some of the PowerPoint presentations. And I understand that he's got a typewritten record. I mean, not like typed with a word processor, but typed with a typewriter, which is pretty hard to go back and edit once you make a chronological record.
Yes.
And it's pretty hard to fake several points of fact about planets in our own solar system like Jupiter and Saturn. Mm-hmm. And these points of fact turned out to be true and accurate. They were backed up by later space missions with satellites to those two planets, and they actually backed up quite technical information that the only way you could have gotten it was to aboard a ship and be pretty close to the planet and make a direct observation. So I found
that
to be
quite right. You get that a lot.
Pretty fascinating.
Sorry, go on.
I think also he is the one that sort of brought the Pleiadians into the whole contact realm. And I guess that this is the one thing that kind of puts me off about it is, you know, that he's got a franchise on these contact these aliens. It's kind of like Zawi Hawass telling the world that Egypt made the pyramids, and anyone who mentions the word in any of their promotions should pay Egypt a royalty. You know, why? I don't understand why Billy Meyer stakes a claim as being the only legitimate contactee of the Pleiadians.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of unusual in the sense that his experiences actually aren't that different to most of the other contactees. You know, it's not like there's something unique about the nature of the experiences. So, you know, that is one of the things that I think a lot of people have wondered about. You know, it's obviously other people have spoken about meeting Pleiadian entities and having contactee experiences from numerous other planets and star systems. But, you know, why there is this insistence that, you know, there are no others from this particular system, to me, that doesn't make any sense. You know, why should it really matter, even?
You know, there's another kind of contact. I don't know if you are thinking about doing a research project on this, but it really seems like, oh, it might be the next generation, but it really seems like it's gaining steam. And that's the idea of star children, of star seed, of individuals who came from other worlds, but they were born here in a human body. And they really feel alien to this world. Have you seen that as a rising phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, you do get this where people have said, you know, that there are certain children, particularly in more recent years, who, you know, maybe their parents have had UFO experiences or something strange happened, and they seem to be somewhat separate or different to other children, you know, very intelligent, spiritual, but and almost eerily distant in some respects also to, you know, to other children, as if they are truly in some way alien. And, you know, people have suggested that these children are kind of popping up here, there, and everywhere, as if, you know, they are representative of some sort of upgrading of the human species in some respects. You know, the idea people talk about things like gene splicing and medical experimentation. Has something been done, in other words, where there's been like a genetic tampering, like at a DNA level even, to kind of almost create like super children or something like that as part of a next generation of being, and then, you know, then you splice them with something else, and it's kind of like constantly improving the pack, so to speak. And I haven't sort of delved into it personally in terms of an investigative angle, but I've read a lot about it, and, you know, there's a lot of interesting stories where people, really having no rhyme or reason or why they should even spread such accounts, but all across the world, you know, there seems to be these accounts of these sort of amazing children with very gifted with certain powers that seem to have a UFO connection to them.
Well, another level, I guess. It's I've read also that maybe the frontal lobes of children being born today are several percent, as high as 10% higher than children born in the 50s, that perhaps the advent of the internet is forming a new neural network that is tying people's consciousness together in a way that we haven't seen before. And even though it's been around for, I don't know, what, 14, 15 years, really, in a serious way, the human race is admittedly on the verge of evolution. There's some kind of change that's taking place before us. Our genetic code is upgrading, just as you mentioned. You know, there's more to the contactee genre than you might think. There's a type of contact that may be as old as the Earth itself. We'll get more into this in the last hour, but I want to touch on to it here. The belief that perhaps these light beings, this interaction with auras and orbs and things like that, has a very close tie to UFOs. If you go back in ancient paintings, depictions of holy beings, or read testimonies of people who have seen holy beings, you see this aura of light around them. Either they come out of an aura of light, or they have an aura of light around them, which in some cases may be white as lightning in the noonday. What have you found in your investigations about this phenomenon?
You mean in terms of the parallels with today's reports, that sort of thing?
Sure, yeah. You know, yeah. The parallels and even, you know, how it might be idiosyncratic with the way that perhaps alien contact has been happening for millennia on this planet.
Yeah, I mean, you can draw those parallels quite deeply. The idea, if you look back at the stories like George Adamski's and Orfeo Angelucci's, you know, other than the fact that they're talking about aliens, the imagery of these sort of higher beings almost looking, I guess, in literal terms, like angelic, you know, in this sort of glowing aura, that they're actually not too different from a lot of religious accounts. You know, it's just the perceived origin of where these things are coming from that is different. And, you know, the experiences began in very similar ways in many of the cases, and again put people on the road to, you know, setting up societies, religions, etc. And, you know, you can literally go back as far as there's been written words or, you know, orally related accounts and legends. And, you know, you do have to wonder, are we just seeing kind of like a modern day version of a very old mystery and just putting a space age spin on it, so to speak?
Sure, yeah. You see in ancient paintings, you'll see what looks like a flying saucer sitting up there in the sky, and a light beam coming down and enlightening the person that's getting the message in the painting.
Yeah, and if you read things like the story of Ezekiel's wheel, you know, that has sort of very much almost like a UFO angle too, this sort of wind coming out of the sky and this object coming down. And, you know, it sounds almost like an advanced helicopter if you read it in some respects. And again, you have to wonder, what would that have actually been, you know, X number of thousands of years ago? What could have actually provoked that sort of encounter to, you know, to see something like that?
How did these, let's talk about crop circles for a little while. I noticed you touch on crop circles in your book. It sort of goes along with the, right after the chapter on altered states of consciousness. This is really an amazing phenomenon. You know, we've talked to Ed and Chris Sherwood on this program, and we've talked to Lucy Pringle, who's taken more aerial photographs of crop circles than just about anybody alive. What's going on with crop circles? What are they trying to say?
Well, you know, I mean, that's an interesting phenomenon. Again, it has, you know, people on all sides of the fence. I moved over to the US 9 years ago, but, you know, prior to that, pretty much every summer I used to go down to where the crop circles would appear, pretty much predominantly in the south of England. And when I was over in 2006, I was fortunate enough to see one. I don't think many people saw it in central England, not too far from where I used to live. We were driving around one day and actually just came across this one particular formation. But crop circles are interesting for several reasons, one being that, contrary to what a lot of people have said, they're not actually a new phenomenon. The reports going back centuries, there's a famous one, an old woodcut from the 1600s in England of something that become known as the mowing devil, and it shows like a flattened area of field with what looks like a little black-skinned goblin-type character inside the field. So that kind of puts a UFO angle on it as well. Now, in saying that, it certainly is the case that most of the reports from England started to develop in the late 70s through the early 80s and really reached their peak from the late 80s to the mid-1990s and onwards to the present day. And again, you know, you have a lot of different theories. One, of course, is the idea that literal aliens are using an advanced technology and beaming something down that flattens the corn. You know, the idea of like an acoustic weapon or something like that can actually, you know, have a vibratory effect, if you like, and flatten the corn down into certain patterns. Other people take kind of like the Gaia view of the Earth, you know, the idea that the Earth's a living, intelligent entity of its own, and that it has the ability to, I guess, influence the planet itself, and that these are messages, you know, warning us about what we're doing to this living entity. And of course, you know, there are cases where people have made circles as well. There's no doubt about that. So, you know, there's several things going on, but there are certain formations, I think, where it gets puzzling is where no one has ever admitted to making them, and they've appeared very, very quickly, I mean, super quickly. And there's been a lot of weird activity attached to them. For example, people seeing strange glowing balls of light hovering over the formations, which would seem to take it far beyond the realm of hoaxing and things like that. So I think there's a genuine phenomenon. I'm just not sure who's doing it or why they're doing it or what's doing it rather than a who, so to speak.
Well, I have read about a few cases, and of course the artwork is becoming increasingly more complex and more fantastic. And I don't know, it appears as though they appear almost instantly in the most amazing conditions. The one I find almost unbelievable is the one that was on a government facility. I believe it was wheat that was laid down. Mm-hmm. The circle was something like 300 feet in diameter. It had like 115 complex circles and spirals in it. It was laid out like the most unmatched fractal you ever saw. In one night, in a driving rainstorm, on a government facility behind fences, and there wasn't a single footprint made, or the mud would have been tracked there. No,
those sort of cases, yeah, that's when it gets really hard to explain. You know, when something appears overnight in pitch black darkness, and sometimes even on slopes, you know, it's not even always on flat ground. It could be at an angle on a hill, which then it gets really difficult. You know, and this is the interesting thing, where you don't find, if it was a person, you know, where are the crop formations where the guy's got it wrong and had to abort it, and, you know, there are aerial photographs of a really bad formation, you know what I mean? We just don't get that. We get really good formations all the time. So
yeah,
that, to me, is a good pointer. And, of course, you know, when you talk about sightings and formations found on government land, that makes it, and, you know, secure, sensitive military installations. There's a place in south of England called Porton Down, which is where the British government does defensive research into things like biological weaponry. So it's a very highly secure location. But back in the 90s, an extensive crop formation was found actually near one of the most sensitive buildings at Porton Down. So not only would these people have had to, you know, beaten the guard dogs, the electric fences and everything else, and got in and made it and got out and avoided all the night scope camera vision, etc., that, you know, guards the base, they did it and, you know, made the formation. So it's things like this that really stretch to the limit the idea that these are all the work of just, you know, a bunch of people leaving the pub and thinking, let's make a crop circle.
Well, you have to admit, I mean, they don't all just happen in Wiltshire. I mean, they happen in America and Canada. They happen in ice. Mm-hmm. I've seen them form on very thin ice, like a quarter of an inch thick, in the middle of a lake.
Mm-hmm.
You can't
walk
out there. You couldn't
go
out there with a boat and do it. This is a thin sheet of ice with snow on top of it, and there's a circle in it. I mean, very complex.
Mm-hmm.
They appear in sand.
Yeah, they're all around the world, and we get a lot in fields. We also get a lot in sand as well.
You talk about a guy who actually goes out and makes the crop circle, but he does so almost under inspiration.
Yes, that's one of the interesting things, is that I actually know a couple of people, a friend of mine named Matthew Williams, who has made a few formations, but rather than being labeled, you know, like a definitive hoaxer, Matthew actually felt compelled to go out and learn how to do this and make specific formations. And Matthew has said that even in the formations that he's made, he's experienced weird phenomena, like seeing strange balls of light hovering over him, even once experiencing like a period of missing time. And Matthew actually feels that there is a genuine phenomenon, an unknown phenomenon behind the crop circles, but he feels that sometimes it actually uses people to, as kind of like its tool to exploit and use them to make the formations, as well as the fact that there are other formations as well. You know, it's kind of like the phenomenon will use whatever it needs to use to make these intricate patterns, and if it needs to, that even involves people. And that kind of puts like an interesting alternative spin on the angle of human circle makers.
Ah, it really does.
It's almost like channeling, but you know, it's kind of like a channeling of, you know, you download a program to your computer. It's almost like the circle maker is downloading a program to allow them to go out and make the formation.
Hmm. The interesting thing that I find about the crop circles is the complexity of those crop circles seem to be really increasing. I mean, I saw a film on them, and it was an independent film done on crop circles, and I don't remember the name of it. But the feeling that I got, I just, you know, watched it because it was at a conference, but the feeling that I got, the way that I felt after I had seen all of those patterns, I gotta say, it altered me. It wasn't that it changed my mind so much as it really influenced a feeling of peace, a feeling of harmony over me. I couldn't really grasp what it was trying to say to me, obviously, if it is a language, but it is certainly iconic, and it does have an effect on you. How are people affected when they are physically there after the crop circle's formed and they go visit it and they walk on it? How are they affected?
Well, that's actually a very good point because, you know, I think, unfortunately, for most people, you know, their only exposure or major exposure to crop circles is seeing photographs in books and magazines. But if you're ever fortunate enough to go into a really intricate crop circle, or a crop formation, it is kind of like an unusual experience. You know, you realize that this isn't like a 3x4 inch photograph in a book. You're actually standing in a highly complex formation that is 300 feet long. You know, it's like a football pitch of intricately flattened ground that has appeared in a matter of, you know, no time at all. And, you know, I've seen people in crop circles who go from either, you know, literally in tears, but tears of joy, or, you know, just so shocked and profoundly shocked, but in a good way also, you know, they're almost literally unable to speak. Other people have said they've experienced like healings, taking away migraines, things like that, to where they feel that there's some sort of energy in the field. But also you do find a lot of people become deeply spiritual. And when I say spiritual, I don't necessarily mean in an organized religious sense, but who take on like a deep caring or develop a deep caring for like the environment, the world, you know, wildlife, to where, again, you know, they sometimes quit their jobs, regular 9-to-5 jobs, and feel that they, you know, they have a need, there's an importance as to why they need to pursue the crop circle mystery and talk about it. And it's, you know, it does have this changing effect on people in varying degrees and from varying perspectives. But, you know, it always, like the UFO subject, it seems to be transformative in many ways.
I observed Tibetans making a mandala out of sand, and they're in a state of meditation, you know, dropping very carefully layered, colored grains of sand to make very complex formations that one could say look like a crop circle. And these go way back. Some go back to the 6th and 7th centuries. I have a person that writes in all the time, Alexander. He says, according to some of the legends, these formations are actually a green Stargate type of technology. And I've had others tell me that maybe these places that it's occurring, they're actually coming from inside the planet, not from outside the planet. I believe I've even heard that the wheat that's harvested from inside a crop circle has different properties than wheat harvested in the same field.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that people have pointed out with some of the crop formations is, what a lot of people don't realize is that when the corn is laid down, it's actually not broken or destroyed in most cases. The farmer, although, you know, farmers don't like people making, or whoever makes the formation, I should say, they don't like, you know, these formations appearing in their fields. However, it doesn't stop, the crop isn't stopped growing, it's just laid flat, so it grows sideways. And so the farmer, in other words, can still reap the crop when it comes time to harvest. It just means all they have to do is lower the blades on the cutter to a lower level so they can get all the wheat up, etc. So in other words, you know, people who eat food that was originally crop circle wheat, you know, may not realize it, but, you know, it's not like the wheat has to be destroyed when a crop circle's made. But there are people who've said that, you know, when, for example, experiments have been done, and, you know, this is verifiable, that there seems to be, in some cases, evidence that the wheat grows at a faster rate, or there's been almost like a genetic alteration in some respects. And, you know, there's been differences, for example, with compasses in, you know, people have taken a compass inside a crop circle or dowsing rods to have them both kind of spin round wildly, as if there's like a latent energy has remained there after the formation has been created, and that this latent energy, whatever it is, continues to have an effect on the crops themselves. And, you know, that in itself is an interesting factor because it suggests, an energy was involved in their creation, so to speak.
Well, here's a question. I probably need to ask someone else, but I don't know. You may know. Is there any record of a crop circle reappearing or another crop circle appearing on the same spot as another one?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain fields in Wiltshire, particularly in England, where every year almost, there's a famous one called the East Field, which is in one particular area of Wiltshire, where there's like a heavy concentration of crop circles every year. And the East Field nearly always has a formation every year. What we do find occasionally is that somebody will find an intricate formation, and then maybe two nights later, another part has been added to the formation. And then, say, a night after that, another complex part's been added to it. So it's almost like what we perceive as being a completed formation is actually added to over time, which kind of makes, you know, sort of begs the question, why and how are these entities coming back and not being seen at all when, you know, people are actually out in the fields, but it's been found, you know, everybody's stumbling all over them, and yet somebody is still, or something is still able to come back and add significant parts to them. That's kind of an interesting thing, you know, that it's almost like artwork in progress. It's not always like a finished formation for, you know, a few days, so to speak.
Absolutely fascinating. Just fascinating. Oh, one of these days I'm going to make my way over there and actually physically experience one. Mm-hmm. We're running a little bit long, second hour. We'll be back in about 6 minutes. Take a break, get something to drink. Relax a little bit. This third hour is going to be amazing. We're going to talk about orbs and energies and lights and how they might affect you and how they're coming about and how they can be observed. More with Nick Redfern and X Squared Radio after this. If you're out there listening live, we invite you to be part of the program, 415-762-1161. If you're listening as an archive, while listening or while working on your favorite project, this is Lisa Gerard, and that's the host of Seraphim. Kind of music you can put headphones on and drift away, even if you're working on those complex AutoCAD plans. Good music is part of the enlightening experience of being here on this planet, and we really appreciate good artists like Lisa Gerard. My guest tonight is Nick Redfern. His book is Contactees. It is subtitled A History of Alien-Human Interaction. You can get it at anywhere where good books are sold. In this hour, the infamous third hour of X Squared Radio, beside taking your phone calls from anywhere around the planet, on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us. We are breaking all records tonight for contact, not only of an alien nature, but also on the networks. People are listening from all over the world, and normally we're in the high 90s. We're somewhere well over the 100 range, which is really incredible. These are not just individuals. These are networks that are tied into BBS Radio right now. So we're being listened to globally. If you want to call in your question live, please feel free to do so. We now have a system where your phone call will roll over to another line. If the line is busy, you will not be put on hold. You'll be able to listen to the program while you're on the phone. 415-762-1161, and we will welcome you to X Squared Radio with us. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. One of the things about humans is we have a tendency to say, I'll believe it when I see it. Well, if you've got a digital camera, you might want to go back through some photographs that you've taken, especially during periods of great joy or great mirth, because somewhere in the photograph you might find a very strange pattern of light. We call them orbs. My friend Michal Ledwith has become a very advanced photographer of orbs, and I know there are many listeners out there who have had experiences with orbs. I know when I was traveling Tibet, you visit some of these old temples that are way, way out of the way, at the top of a dry riverbed, and you walk into the temple, and these are places that pilgrims sometimes spend their entire lives to get to these temples so that they can visit Maitreya or they can visit some Buddha of some kind. Hanging from the ceiling, from what we would call fishing line, are what we would also call Christmas ornaments. Now, I'm not talking about snowflakes. I'm talking about blue and red and gold and silver balls of glass of various sizes. When I visited this with my guide, my guide's name was Punsala, and I said, Punsala, why don't you ask them, what are the glass balls hanging from the ceiling in various patterns? And he came back and he said, well, they're probably planets in some kind of arrangement. And I looked at them again and I said, no, they don't look like a planet. There's no sun. There's no solar system. Ask them again and ask them to describe it as best they can. And so he came back and he said, well, they're like light beings. Only when pilgrims arrive, sometimes they're dimensionally blind. They can't really see the higher masters up there. And so, like we can, so we hang them from the ceiling like glass balls so that when they arrive, they're not disappointed. They realize that the higher masters are here and that they're watching them and that their visit was not in vain. I said, Punsala, they're orbs. They hung orbs from the ceiling because the monks see them all the time because they're in a higher state of consciousness with the naked eye. But we, dimensionally blind Westerners, we need digital cameras to see them. We need the flash of light and the ultra sensitivity of the chip in the camera in order to pick up the orb. And it's amazing how many there are. There are millions upon millions of them. Not to go on extemporaneously, but I was at a gathering at James Gilliland's up at, in Trout Lake, Washington. And there was a gentleman there with an infrared spotlight and a set of infrared binoculars. Now, the interesting thing was, and believe me, that the spirit of this place is just untenable. It's really so thick you can cut it with a knife almost. But when you put the infrared goggles on, the binoculars, and then you shine the infrared spotlight over the heads of the people, you didn't see a few orbs. There was an ocean of orbs, like a flowing, waving river of orbs, uncountable, millions of them, billions of them, of all different sizes. Of course, everything's green in the infrared goggles, but still, they're there. Now, in your interviews and in your research, Nick, you came across this idea that there are perhaps primal beings of light that have always been on this planet. What are you making of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, this to me is one of the most interesting aspects of the contactee phenomenon, and it's one that's actually been massively overlooked. And this is the idea that, as you said, you know, people see orbs, people see strange glowing balls of light. Many of them associate, as I said earlier, with crop circles, but more importantly, they seem to exhibit evidence of being under intelligent control, or possibly even that they are some sort of sentient, intelligent being in their own right. You know, in the same way we're flesh and blood, they're more ethereal, but they still appear to show evidence of intelligence. Now, one of the things I found in going back and looking at many of the early contactee cases of the 50s and 60s was that although the contactees out in the deserts late at night, etc., reported seeing definitive flying saucers and aliens, the experiences often began with the witnesses seeing balls of light in the sky at a low level, sometimes, you know, just hovering and bobbing up and down maybe 6 to 10 feet in front of them and maybe 15 feet off the ground, often described as perhaps the size of like a beach ball or a basketball, or perhaps a little bit larger, that would approach them, almost, I guess, like transfix them and hypnotize them. And then before their eyes, this flying saucer or aliens would appear. And this, if this was a one-off thing, then we could just ride it off to just a strange experience. But there are now literally dozens of reports on file, a number of which I relate in the book, about how some of the major contactee experiences began with the witnesses being exposed to these balls of light, and then, lo and behold, suddenly it transforms into a gleaming flying saucer. And one of the things that I touch upon is the way in which, for example, the British Ministry of Defense had done research into what they called like ghost lights and plasmas and felt that they could have an effect on the temporal lobe of the human brain. In other words, influencing what the human mind sees, hears, and how it interprets these events. Now, the Ministry of Defense concluded that this phenomena would have to be a wholly natural one, you know, that just has the ability to play games with the human mind. But I speculate on the fact that it seems to show evidence of intelligence, that possibly that we really are being exposed to a truly alien entity that is literally like a ball of light, but to have a meaningful conversation or a communication with us actually manipulates the human mind to where we see it in the format that it wants us to see it, and it probably uses our subconscious and picks up imagery from our subconscious to appear in a way that is acceptable to us. And that may, as I also speculate, explain how and why the phenomenon seems to ever change as cultural beliefs change. So in the way in which we subconsciously think of higher entities change, and so when this entity interacts with us, it picks up accordingly on those changes, and that's how it appears. But there's clear evidence now, in my view, that many contactee experiences, or a lot of them, begin with these balls of light, and then it, you know, it develops from there, so to speak.
One of the cases that you mention in your book is Joseph Smith's encounter with the angel Moroni. How did you put that in the book?
Well, you know, this is where things get a little bit. Whenever you start talking about religion, etc., and bringing into, you know, flying saucers, inevitably, it can create division. It can create hostility. You know, and some people get kind of upset by it. But my view is that when we see clear and distinct parallels between certain visionary experiences that have UFO overtones to them as well and vice versa, then it be sort of behooves us, we've got to look into it, you know, because otherwise it does become a belief system of just listening to the stories you want to hear and discarding the ones you don't. But, you know, I'm sure everybody's heard of Joseph Smith and Mormonism. Joseph Smith, who was born in 1805, you know, founder of the Latter-day Saint movements, or more commonly known as Mormonism. But what happened was that the reason and the how and why of Joseph Smith came to, I guess, found the Latter-day Saint movement is because he had an experience in 1827 when he said he was visited by an angel named Moroni, who, as it transpires, visited him late one night while he slept, which, again, is a staple part of a lot of UFO encounters where somebody has an experience with higher beings in the middle of the night. And basically, the angel supposedly directed him to a book which was inscribed on a set of golden plates that reportedly detailed a visit that Jesus made to the Americas, you know, when Jesus was alive. And the story was that this particular book was buried on a hill near Smith's home. And 3 years later, Smith published, under the title of the Book of the Mormon, what he said was a translation of these plates, which was essentially, you know, a translation of the whole ideology of Mormonism. So, again, you know, you have Joseph Smith having this experience with a higher entity, if you like, and passing on a message of, this is how you need to live, and then creating an organization that developed a deep following. Now, in 1893, a famous engraving was made of Joseph Smith interacting with this angel Moroni. And Moroni, this particular angel in the drawing, in this artist rendition, actually looks like one of the classic aliens in the contactee stories, like a tall, angelic, human-looking figure with hair extending over his ears and sort of slim and wise looking, and with this aura of light shining down from the sky above him. So, you know, one man's angel in the 1700s becomes another man's space alien in the California desert in the 1950s. So again, you know, there's a very definitive similarity in my view between these two events and cases.
Yeah, you know, from an outside point of view, it does make sense. If you read, for instance, the book of Genesis from the same point of view, by the time you get out of, I don't know, the fifth book, the fifth chapter of Genesis, you've been introduced to five races, none of whom are from Earth. Mm. It's just interesting. Hey, we've got Tim on line one. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Didn't really have a question, but I did want to give a testament to the orbs you were talking about at East City and kind of tell you my story.
Yeah,
my
absolutely.
Experience with it. First time I've seen them like that. Same kind of story. A gentleman had the night vision glasses, and there were myself and two others who spied the guy who had the glasses, and we walked up and asked if we could look through them, and I was the third in line, which was kind of unfortunate, but the first guy grabs the glasses and starts panning around, and his draw drops, and he starts to spurt out expletives. And so the second guy is Anson to grab the glasses, and he finally gets a hold of them, and he turns around towards the line of trees that are behind the field. And he's just in awe looking at what he's looking at and what he's describing. And I didn't get to see this by the time I got the glasses, but what he was describing was a waterfall of orbs coming over the trees into the field. And that was the day right before the we did the Fibonacci spiral.
Right,
we had a small
right.
drumming circle. We had a small drumming circle, and they were just flowing in like that. And then finally I got the glasses another minute or two later, looked to where he was looking, where they were coming over the trees. They weren't. I saw a lot of orbs coming in, but not quite how he described them coming in as a waterfall. But I panned over the field, and they were just indescribable. I mean, when I have captured them on digital camera and stuff, and people say, well, you know, it's dust or it's this or it's that. It is not dust.
You know, that was, how did you feel when that happened, Tim?
I was in a different state of mind since the minute I pulled into that place. The entire weekend was indescribable. I mean, I bet you I didn't sleep 4 hours a night the whole time I was there. But when I was witnessing them, and then I believe it was Mr. Kelly was one of the speakers, or the guy that did the reverse speech.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
He had a camera set up, and he had different things. He had one way where he could set up on infrared, one way where he could set it up on, I think he was doing ultraviolet, infrared, and some different spectrums. But he was just sitting on the picnic table there, just kind of panning the crowd back and forth, and I sat and talked with him and looked through his viewer. And we were just seeing individual things shooting by, and they would come in front of the lens and just kind of park themselves in front of the lens and go straight up or sideways after a second or two, and that was extremely interesting. I think he's going to have some good footage online pretty soon, too.
But, that was really an amazing experience for two nights, or maybe three, We were out there. One of the nights we set up this energy device, which is called the live stream generator, but this was a very powerful one. It was like 5.5 million volts. And we set it up in the middle of the field, and we created a big spiral with the people and all held hands, and then either myself or John touched the generator, and the energy went through everyone. And after about, 15, 18 minutes, something like that, everyone started to kind of laugh, and the mirth began, and this is when the orbs just turned into an ocean. Nick, in your experience with this, did you find that the orbs showed up every single time, or do you think there was a certain expectation or a certain qualification of the conditions under which the orbs showed up?
Well, you know, I mean, we can only sort of look at a lot of the reports, I guess, retrospectively. It doesn't seem to be the case that the encounters began with orbs on every occasion that the witnesses saw these entities, but it was the initial experience, the very first one they had, that seemed to be orb-related. But from then on, it was almost, you know, the phenomenon would take on its second form as a first form in all the subsequent encounters. And I think also, you know, there's something to be said possibly for the setting. For example, in my contactees book, I've got a photograph of numerous orbs that I took. Obviously, I didn't see anything at the time, but in a place called the Integratron, which is a large building out in the California desert built by a contactee named George Van Tassel, which he said was a building built on the orders of the aliens that he met, and the plan was that it ultimately would possess technology to enhance and extend the human lifespan. But he never actually finished it, unfortunately. But, you know, I went in there, took a lot of photographs, and of all places I could have got orbs on film, it was in the Integratron. I've reproduced one of these photographs in the book with literally about a dozen or more orbs floating around the interior ceiling of the Integratron. So I think, you know, it's possible that not only does the phenomenon have a bearing on the the nature of the experience, but possibly the location. Maybe there are certain areas of the planet these things are tied to, you know, or certain areas. I think that's something we shouldn't necessarily rule out. And it might explain why, for example, in Texas, you have the famous Marfa lights, these strange balls of light flitting around the countryside, you know, but they're all dominated in one area. Perhaps there are certain areas where these things exist or have to exist.
I know in North Carolina they have the brown yep. mountain lights.
Yep. Yeah, it's actually one I talk about in the book, a famous contactee case, a man named Ralph Lael. And Ralph's story is actually very interesting. So one of my favorites. He lived at the bottom of Brown Mountain, or very close to the bottom of Brown Mountain in North Carolina. And so he grew up on the legends of these strange ghostly balls of light flitting around the woods on the mountain. And he would often go up into the mountain to try and see them, and actually did on several occasions. On one particularly notable occasion in 1962, he said that he actually got close, very close to one of these orbs, which was actually quite large. He said it almost grew to like a size of about 10 feet in diameter and seemed to have like spokes coming off it. And as he kind of stood there transfixed looking at it, again, he went through the classic motion that so many of the contactees of the 50s went through, where the orb, as it transfixed him and he stared at it, was suddenly changed, and in its place were two very human-looking alien beings who reportedly, you know, again, reeled off the typical stuff about the perils of nuclear war. Now, what's interesting about Ralph's story is that I'm 100% convinced he honestly related the story as he experienced it, but it's interesting that the week of his experience, where he was warned by the aliens about nuclear war, this was the same week when the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 was going on, which almost, you know, ended up in nuclear war between America and Russia, which, you know, everybody would have lost. And, you know, I speculate in the book that this was at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. This intelligence was picking up upon Ralph Lael's fears that everybody, you know, would have had about nuclear war in that particular incident was taking place, and that it picked up and kind of answered his fears in a way to sort of placate him and calm him down, but that wisely Space Brothers were going to help us. And he actually did, you know, he felt afterwards that everything was going to be okay, and as it turned out, it was. So, you know, I think we need to look at that as well. Maybe the phenomenon kind of picks up on our internal worries and concerns and gives us a positive message back. You know, it's almost trying to help us in that respect even.
What about the idea that, you know, these are almost like a very complex but almost spiritual dimension of life itself? You know, we were talking about the origin of light on our life on the earth, and lots of research has been done on this. Certain conditions have been put together, different experiments have been done to try to replicate the conditions on the earth, and you talk about one such experiment in your book about creating a sort of primal earth chamber with argon gas in it, and then, you know, starting lightning bolts in it. What did they observe when they did this experiment?
You know, this is the interesting thing, you know, the idea that we can, with our technology, you know, that we can potentially spontaneously manifest these things. And the story you're talking about actually involved a man, a physicist named Mircea Sandol Ovichiu, I think I pronounced that right, who was working at the time at the university in Romania. And they basically had tried to replicate conditions that they believed existed on our planet in its earliest times, and actually created, as they were described, as blobs of plasma that actually seemed to be alive. What they did, they created this chamber out of argon gas in kind of like a plasma state, then introduced powerful arcs of electricity, so kind of representing lightning storms. What they found were that cell-like spheres of plasma are actually spontaneously created in less than a second in the wake of creating these lightning storms. And they seem to have an outer layer of negatively charged ions, and they could grow, replicate by dividing, and actually even seem to communicate with each other in some way. which of course, you know, is very profound. It was almost, had they given birth to, or, you know, unleashed an old, a new version of a very old, an ancient life form that wasn't flesh and blood like us, but seemingly had intelligent properties and was able to communicate with each other and et cetera, almost like a hive type mentality, you know, like an insect hive mentality. And of course, but these were created basically in the lab in a scientific setting. Now, of course, if these things did exhibit evidence of intelligence, and, you know, who's to say that they aren't already around us and haven't been for millions of years? And maybe, you know, the reason, as I speculate in the book, the reason they make contact with us is because, you know, we're intelligent beings. Possibly they're looking to contact other intelligences. You know, I speculate that if they really were some of the very first, most primitive life forms on the planet, you know, they were dreadfully alone and were looking for other life forms to engage conversation in, etc., in simplistic terms. And maybe when we came along, you know, that they finally found someone on their level, or a species on their level with whom they could communicate, possibly.
Well, that would be interesting, and it kind of makes an interesting case on several different levels.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting angles it kind of makes a case on is the fact that, you know, it would help explain why the phenomenon, the UFO phenomenon, is always changing, you know, or whether or general mysteries are changing, going from demons to goblins to fairies to aliens to the little black-eyed aliens of today. It's the phenomenon is forced to change as we change, you know, and it has to upgrade its appearance for us over the years. And, you know, 50 years from now, they may be appearing as something else, but people are still maybe seeing the initial experience as the ball of light, and then something else appears. So, well, you know, I do think there's a lot to be said for that theory.
On the one hand, it could be our manifestation that's allowing this to morph.
Yeah, I think it could be a combination of the two. Maybe it picks upon, you know, maybe if this phenomenon has the ability to influence the human mind, it may do that by actually getting into the human mind. And if it can kind of register what we're seeing, then, you know, I mean, thinking in our mind, perhaps it uses the subconscious of different people, you know, to appear in ways that are acceptable to that person. And that might also explain why so many different types of UFO have been seen, you know, not just one type. You know, if everybody has it in their heads what a UFO should look like, that might explain why everybody's UFOs are slightly different, because the phenomenon is individually picking on, you know, the witnesses and and creating their own unique UFO.
That's a really good thought. You know, one of the things that molecular biologists have to admit is that when they look at life itself, sure, it's easy to put the building blocks together to make amino acids, but to make a complex protein, something like DNA or something like an enzyme, that's a different story altogether. That takes engineering, that takes intention, it takes intelligence to put those things together. It is not just improbable, it's impossible for these proteins to synthesize out of themselves. But if you're familiar with Dr. Bruce Lipton's work, for instance, you see that there is a dimensional pattern into which the biological material, the molecular biological material, actually fills in the pattern during the creation of life from two cells. You start with two cells with all the genetic material, but how does a cell know to become a spinal cord or an eye or a muscle or a, you know, brain tissue? It knows this because each cell differentiates according to a spiritual pattern that it happens to be filling in. Maybe the orb is the spiritual pattern.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. And I think, you know, regardless of people's personal opinions on the paranormal and things like this, it's quite right what you've said, you know, that when life begins, it's almost as if, you know, something, as you said, fills in the blanks, and there's an intelligence at work where cells are driven to multiply, split, etc. You know, some cells, you know, responsible for creating teeth or fingers, etc. There's this encoded thing where there's an intelligent aspect at work. And, you know, I think there's massive numbers of questions to be answered about these aspects of life itself that we just don't understand. And, you know, in some respects, maybe, you know, there's a tie-in here somewhere.
Well, not only does your intelligence, your intention, your manifestations affect the presence or non-presence of orbs or their shape or their activities, it also affects the very genetic material that makes up your body over time. Mm-hmm. And this has been clinically proven more times than you could count, where they have taken identical twins who are genetically identical at birth, and then resampled them over time throughout their lives and found that by the time they're 20 or 30 years old, their genetics drift apart.
Mm.
Because inside the biological being is the spiritual being,
mm-hmm.
which are obviously two separate intelligences,
mm-hmm.
influencing the ongoing process of making genetic material in that body.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good point, you know, and I think, again, you know, when we're looking at intelligence, we're looking at the nature of intelligence, and, you know, as you specifically point out then, we tend to look at the human race, I think, as just, or all animals, just flesh and blood. But intelligence and, you know, an intelligent entity has many different aspects to it, you know, whether it's spiritual, physical, etc. And I think that, again, could explain how and why these orbs, for example, could be evidence of intelligence. You know, we don't have to just focus on the flesh and blood to know that there could be intelligence at work or there's a pattern. You know, that there could be all manner of life forms out there that, you know, we just don't really understand to any degree just yet. So we're just, you know, grasping for straws in many respects.
Hmm. Very interesting. And if you're a life form out there and you have access to a cell phone, 415-762-1161. We've got about 15 minutes left. You want to be part of the program.
Even now an orb, if the orbs want to call in. So.
Yeah, exactly. Contactees is the book. And the subtitle is The History of Alien-Human Interaction, sold where all good books are sold. I've read it twice, got notes all through the margins. It's a good read. Our guest has been Nick Redfern tonight. One of the things, Nick, that fascinates me about this subject, and I'm so glad that we had you on the program and look at this from a journalistic point of view instead of an experiencer or somebody who's perhaps got an axe to grind or a dollar to make from another aspect, is that you have very academically assembled a good work which gives us a perspective of how contact with, shall we say, I don't want to call it alien intelligence. Maybe it's, as your friend says, maybe it's inside the Earth. Maybe these are ancient races that have always lived here. And maybe there are some that come from other worlds. I mean, after all, we are a pretty remarkable planet sitting out here in the blackness of space,
mm-hmm.
certainly different than the other eight planets in our solar system. And I don't know, 8,000 or 9,000 light years in every direction. We're pretty unique. And we're broadcasting all kinds of intelligence from this planet, some of it not so intelligent and not so peaceful. And maybe we're a point of interest along the cosmic highway.
Mm.
And maybe these contacts are taking place. And maybe those contacts sometimes go ignominious, or go underground, or go incognito, and some become very flamboyant and history-making.
So, yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, the idea that we try and, I guess, put the UFO subject into one particular box, so to speak. And, you know, I think it's entirely possible that, you know, some UFOs could be some sort of indigenous ancient human race of some sort. Others could be alien, some could be interdimensional, you know, we have the orbs. I think there is this tendency for people to think UFOs are all unified under one banner. That may not actually be the case. There could be, you know, a lot of different origins for a lot of different UFO experiences. We could be just trying to file it under one because that's where one we, you know, that's the way we presume it works.
What role do you think science fiction plays in the morphing and the evolution of alien contact?
Well, I think certainly the way in which science fiction plays a good role, a positive role, in the UFO mystery is that it certainly brings the subject to the general public and popular culture. You know, films like Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T., particularly those two, they were, you know, massive blockbusters. And, you know, something like Star Wars or Star Trek is, yeah, it deals with it with alien life, and, you know, it's like a fantasy scenario, you know, space adventures, etc. Something like E.T. and Close Encounters were more UFO-dominated and sort of really brought to the public's attention, you know, the UFO angle of the sci-fi genre. And I think anything that takes like a serious but entertaining approach and makes people think has to be a good thing. And I think also, on the other side of the coin, so to speak, I think the world of UFOlogy has worked in a positive way to influence science fiction writers. You know, somebody has a UFO experience and then a film or a book appears, you know, based around that same sort of scenario. But again, if it's based around allegedly real events, then again, it opens and exposes people through the medium of science fiction to, you know, potentially what's really going on. So, you know, I think science fiction can play an important role, you know, but obviously that for entertainment purposes, it's not going to be exactly as, you know, people have reported. But if it helps get the story out there and it helps to make people think about it, I think that's a good thing. So.
Yeah, and you have to wonder where the ideas, you know, come from. Like,
there are stories, for example, like, you know, a lot of legends within the UFO subject that, for example, there may have been people in government who kind of subtly nudged Steven Spielberg into certain directions, you know, how to portray E.T. and Close Encounters to try and get the general public thinking about UFOs, and that, you know, it wasn't an official government project to make the films or anything like that, but there may have been people in government who felt, you know, it'd be an idea for a film like this or those to be made just to see how the public responds. I actually think there's evidence that's happened on a few times where government agencies appear to have taken a deep interest in the world of science fiction and seeing how they can use it.
Oh, sure. I mean, government has used media even during, you know, World Wars One and Two. Yeah. The government used the media community to build support for the war.
Yeah.
I was going to throw out a name, James Cameron. I mean, look what he's done with The Abyss and now with Avatar. Yeah. It's just phenomenal how he resonates with what's going on out there.
Yeah, I think anything, I mean, obviously Avatar, you know, people have drawn the parallels between what's going on today in our world, and I think, you know, it makes people think. I think anything that can kind of entertain and inform and make people wonder about things, you know, that's a good thing. They don't necessarily have to always agree with it, but if it kind of acts as a vessel for provoking conversation and discussion, then, you know, I don't see anything wrong with that at all, so.
Do you think the Earth is going through an evolutionary change, the planet itself?
Well, you know, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, there's no doubt there's some weird stuff going on right now with the weather, you know, the environments, just the strange weather going on, you know, global warming, polar ice caps, ozone layer, earthquakes, you know, certainly that throughout the years, you know, the millions of years, the planet has had upheavals like ice ages, floods, you know, cataclysm, disasters. And, you know, we seem to be having our fair share of it right now. You know, viruses, just weird viruses breaking out. And it's almost, you know, as if we are going through one of these stages. And, you know, I sometimes wonder if, you know, it's nature's way of, when things go bad, that, you know, nature way finds a way of cleaning something up and then starts over again. You know, it's almost like the human race is reaching, I mean, levels now where we literally will find it difficult to sustain people 100 years from now. If the population keeps increasing with the over-reliance on oil, petrol, etc., more and more of the, you know, the wild forests, woodlands, rainforests vanishing, And, you know, and of course, a lot of people forget we rely upon plants, for example, to convert carbon dioxide into oxygen. You know, we destroy the plants and the forests, etc. We're in big trouble. So, you know, if the planet itself, as some people think, has, you know, like the Gaia scenario, is a living entity, and these parasites, these billions of parasites, human beings, are messing up the planet for everything else, maybe, you know, it's nature's way of trying to wipe us out bit by bit, you know, viruses, earthquakes, you know, let's kill a few thousand off here, let's introduce a virus there. And, you know, maybe nature itself is like an intelligent entity that keeps the balance by wiping out what's, you know, the thing that's past its prime and, you know, is now working against the planet. So.
Yeah, maybe the planet itself is having an allergic reaction to the human
race.
Yeah,
I mean, it's kind of like that, the film, I forget, The Happening, I don't know if you saw that one, you know, where the planet, it was just released about 2 years ago, where the plants themselves release like a virus which causes people to start committing suicide.
Oh, right.
And it's quite an interesting film. It's you know, like a biological virus, but it affects people's minds to where they literally kill themselves. And everybody on the planet, you know, at the end of the film, it starts spreading from America over to Paris. And then, you know, you get the implication that everybody's going to be gone and all the other animals and everything's just going to continue blissfully as before. So.
Yeah, M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, that's right. That's the one, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very, very strange themes.
Oh, yeah, he's done some weird, interesting films.
Well, Nick, it's been fascinating. I love the book. It's going on the shelf under the letter C. And tonight's archive will be mixed down in about an hour, so it'll be available for you. If you missed the first hour or the second hour, you can go back and listen. I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's been a great, great interview, and we'll look for you out there. Are you interviewing? Are you having any conferences in the coming months?
Well, coincidentally, actually, this coming Tuesday night, I'm speaking in San Antonio. I live in Dallas. I'm driving down to San Antonio. I'm speaking at the San Antonio chapter of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. And I forget the actual address, but if you go on a search engine and type in San Antonio MUFON, M-U-F-O-N, you'll find their website. It has the address of where the meetings are held. So I'll be speaking about the book down there on Tuesday night. That's the next upcoming one I've got.
Well, excellent. We'll look for you out there somewhere.
Alrighty.
Thank you very much for coming on the program.
Well, thanks, Brooks. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Good night, sir.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
I just want to let you know really quick, if you're out there working on your favorite project, don't forget about the Ark of Millions of Years trilogy, arkofmillionsofyears.com. If you order through the website, you not only get the books autographed, you also get the audiobooks of volumes 1 and 2 with them. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you. I got a fourth book coming out. I'm going to give you the title in about 2 weeks. We're working some challenges out with the publisher as we speak. And then the book will be available in about 3 months as it goes through the publishing process. So I want you to take care out there, Earth Explorers. We're almost through the month of February. The year 2010 is going to be history-making, to say the least. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying peace, Earth Explorers.
Is brought to you from HempUSA.org, supplier of fine hemp products, sponsoring the BBS.com radio network, the leader in internet radio.
My clothes, they are money. I wear the best, I have lots of money. Look at my hair, it's an expensive cut. I know one thing, it looks real good. And I wear the cheese string cause it makes me feel hot. It makes me cool and it hugs my butt. I know girls look at me and sometimes I look at them too. And you know what they say, hey, I'm the man. I am the man. I am the man. I am so cool. I am so great. I am the man. Yes, I am the man. I love myself. I love no other. Except my mother. Down the street some days I look in the mirror and I have to gaze at my reflection coming back at me. And I can't believe that is me. Look at me. Hot, very hot. I am constantly getting gifts for free. I say, hey, let's go shopping and buy something for me. You know, watches, clothes, and things like that. And I get the receipt. You can take it back. I am the man. I am so cool. I am so great. Yes, I am a man. I love myself. I love my mother. It's for my mother. I am the man. I am so cool. I am so great. I am a man. Yes, I am a man. I love myself. I love my mother. It's for my mother. My women are always telling me how good I make the love. I move my butt in a circular fashion. It does the job. Sometimes when I'm feeling oh so nasty, I do not haste. I place my woman on a pedestal. I place her on my face. I am the man. I am so cool. I am so great. I am the man. Yes, I am the man. I love myself. I love my mother. Except my mother.
I am the man.
I am the man.
I am the man. I am the man.
I am so great.
I am the man.
Yes, I am. I have something I must confess to you. The truth is, I am none of these things. my parents. I don't even have a car. I wash dishes during the day, and I sit alone at my computer all night chatting with lonely women. But to these women, I own something more, something special, something missing in their life. To them, I am the man.
I am the man.
I am the man.
I am the man. I am the man.
I am so cool.
I am the man. Yes, I am.
Almin, the greatest mystic of our time, invites you to join her as she shares powerful revelations of a world where mystery and miracles are commonplace. To find out more about Almin and her work for the Mother Goddess of All Life, visit spiritualjourneys.com. As a Toltec Nahual, Almin leads a life dedicated to setting others free from illusions, and her insights into cosmology and man's role in the macrocosm are undeniably groundbreaking. Sunday nights at 8:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, tune into Windows into Eternity for the most cutting-edge discussion of ascension one can find.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in to BBS Radio. Up next, of course, is Donna Fox, Akashic Wisdom, but it won't be live. Tonight, we are going to do an archive. That archive is dated April 12, 2009. Now, Donna is sick. She hasn't been feeling well. So we ask that you send out your thoughts and your healing energy to her. She would very much appreciate it. Again, tonight we are not going live. We are doing an archive for Donna Fox, Akashic Wisdom. That archive is dated April 12th, 2009. So settle in and enjoy the program.
Hi there, everyone. This is Donna Fox, and you are listening to Akashic Wisdom, the television show. Nope, not yet. The radio show that gives you all the information about the Akashic Records, helps you decipher and communicate with your soul. And we talk about things about your life. We talk about things about life. We talk about things, the depths of the world that we're in, and we talk about the depth of our hearts and our souls. We don't necessarily talk about futures. We talk about the here and now. We talk about not psychic things so much as why we chose to do the things that we do, or why we have in our life the people we have or the situations we have, so that we can find greater meaning. And the bottom line is to find the basic forgiveness of ourselves and to move into our self-love in a more meaningful way. For when we find and move into that love of self, we move into a glorious place of knowing that expands our wisdom and expands our ability to look at our own possibilities. You know, one of the things that we have here many times is the short view of ourselves, and we don't really look at our own possibilities or our own abilities and light. So here on Akashic Wisdom is something that we want to take a look at that and uncover things about ourselves. And we have a caller right now. And hi there. Well, we did have a caller, so caller, if you're there, you can call, you know, if you hung up, please call back. For those people who are listening out there, we are open to your calls. If you're out there and would like to call in toll-free, you certainly can do that. Telephone number worldwide is 888-815-9756. That's the number, 888-815-9756. And if for some reason you don't want to use the toll-free number, and that's great because I have free long distance on all my phones, you can call direct at 530-876-3222. So, as we were saying, we have, by the way, you know, for those people who are a little shy and would rather not call in but would like to email me a question, I have some great questions coming in already, but you can email me, and you, by the way, you can email me tonight to put your question on the show. And if you're emailing me with a question on for the show, please include your current legal name. I will not mention the name on the air, except for your first name. But do, if you have any other questions about the Akasha or how I work or what my class schedules are, etc., please do give a call. You can call me directly. And again, you can leave a message during the show. I won't be able to answer it right now. But my direct line is 216-691-1233. That's my private number. Again, 216-691-1233. But during the show, if you want to email me questions or ask the show, anytime you want to email me, or if you'd like to get on my email list, you can email me at info@akashicwisdom. That's akashicwisdom.com. So you can just go ahead and log in and go ahead and send me some information or send me some questions. You know, we had an interesting question today via the email. The question was, it's kind of a general question. I love when we have general questions we can talk about here too. So, what the question was what power or energy do photographs hold? Now, the reason that's important, there's actually an Akashic Records answer to that. So the question is that pictures or photographs, what essence or power do they hold? And there was, like, recently this particular person had was looking at pictures that she hadn't seen in over 20 years and was amazed by the impact the images had on her emotional body. So actually that's an interesting question. And one of the things we want to look at is that we want to remember is that everything has vibration and frequency, and you've heard me say this before if you've been listening to Akashic Wisdom. Everything has vibration and frequency, and at the moment that your essence, if you will, is captured on film, that essence is actually held in that photograph. What's interesting about that is that if a person, now this is actually a psychic answer, which I find interesting. There was a time where I was taught, this is before I found the Akasha, how to actually hold a photograph with the picture down and actually be able to receive and read the vibrations of the picture and the essence that were left there and do an actual quote-unquote reading on the person to help the person who's they gave me the photograph. And so my teacher actually at that time taught me how to read photographs without looking at the picture, just to read the energy of the photograph without looking at the picture, which I found interesting. And then we would then turn the picture over and then give further detail of of the essence of what we got from the picture. And, you know, it's interesting because what's coming to me now, that would be interesting to do. And I would be very interested in doing that. If there are people who are interested in sending in their photographs or photographs of people they would like readings for, you could actually send them to my post office box, and that would be of interest to me. My P.O. box is 22951, and that's in Cleveland, Ohio, 44122. Excuse me. And so, so that would be of interest, very much of interest to me. If you would, I would like to actually experiment with photographs to see what could be shown or what kind of information could be brought. Not to invade someone's privacy, but I would be interested to see if how that would work. So what's being said here is that the photograph itself carries an essence of information that you that the person almost leaves behind. You know, there are some belief systems that don't allow their followers to be photographed. For example, the Amish people won't allow themselves to be photographed at all, and I found that very interesting. Very interesting. The other thing is that you can also, I guess what's interesting to me more than anything else is that the essence of the person, okay, the essence of the person is left behind in that photograph to a certain extent. To a certain extent, that's what they're telling me. They're saying that the essence of a human being that is captured on film and that essence can be read and looked at. So I find that very interesting. So, okay, now you have that. And that's an interesting, I'm just kind of being carried into different places here. And so I just find that fascinating. Anyway, all right, so I hope you have that information. I hope that helped you understand that actual photographs have an interesting way of carrying our essence with them. Same way your voice does. You know, there's a lady on, I think she's still on VBS, that has a program. Her name is Sherry Edwards, and she can read your information based on your voice. And I don't know if she, I'm sorry, I have to apologize. I've not listened to her show, but I have heard that she has, that she can do readings and has information about, she does information regarding illness also. Illness would be helpful. She also has, she can do a diagnosis about illness, and I find that interesting. So you might want to take a look at that and consider that the pictures that we take of ourselves or other people, you know, really are windows to our souls at the time. You can actually look into a picture of a person's eyes and sometimes actually see the clarity of their thoughts. So you may want to take a look at that because that's kind of interesting as well. So talk to me. There was that caller. I would love to have you call back. And if, in fact, that's of interest to you, please do. And then there was another question I'm looking for here. Let me just get this to you. Okay, so let's go back to this email. Ah, okay. And here's another question. The question that's here is that we're talking about the capacity of the planet, and that the question is, what can the Akashic Records tell us about the population capacity of planet Earth? And what effect does this, does making this an issue create in our world? And is overpopulation causing weather catastrophes, etc.? I think that's a very interesting observation, very interesting type of question. Here's what the records are saying right now is that there are many man-made, human-made conceptions of what is true and what is not true from a fear-based point of view. We have to know as humans that in order for us to be open with our own information and to be able to move into our own life, we have to be very much aware of our abilities, if you will, to stay out of quote-unquote fear. That's what's very, very important. We have to be able to stay out of fear. So what does that tell us? That tells us that human beings that are on the planet now have the ability, if you will, to create their future and create their lives to the point of really moving into a space of not worrying whether or not there are enough people or if there's not enough to go around. So what's important about that is that when we come from a space of lack, when we start worrying that there is not, quote-unquote, enough, then we come from a place of lack, and that is what really affects our whole concept, our whole mentality on the planet. So worrying about whether or not there's enough or that our population of people is taking something away from us is really coming from a place of lack. And we really want to look at that and at us not doing that. So what the record keepers are saying is that we should really be mindful of the earth, really be sensitive to the earth's needs, not to be wasteful, but not to see, there's an issue here around fear. If we move into conserving our energy and taking care of Mother Earth and stopping global warming out of fear, then we're not stopping anything. We need to stop doing our wastefulness because we want to add to the joy of the planet. We want to be able to move into the abundance and prosperity and opulence of the planet, to encourage the opulence, to encourage the abundance, not out of fear that there won't be enough because there are, quote-unquote, too many people, or et cetera. So we really need to take a look at our mindset, you see. When we allow ourselves in other areas, now this is an important piece. We have to, you know, you think about the different places that we allow fear and lack to enter into our lives. It's very insidious. So if we walk around saying there are too many people, I must go green because I'm going to quote unquote waste energy, and if I waste energy there won't be enough, that defeats the idea of going green, because it's like you're taking one step forward and three steps back. The idea of having a sustainable earth a sustainable livelihood or a sustainable environment is not, we should not do that out of fear. We should do out of joy and honor. And so the record keeper is very clear for us to begin to look at where we create or hold the beliefs of lack. Because it's our intention. When we intend to do something out of fear or out of lack, we totally negate the positive aspects of that outcome, if you will. So, again, as we do things in our life, we really need to be able to outline, if I'm talking choppy, it's because I'm repeating what the record keepers are saying. So I apologize to you if you're listening for the first time, but I tell you exactly what I see, hear, or sometimes feel based on what the Akashic Record masters, teachers, and loved ones are giving me. So as I repeat it, it can be choppy. But again, what they're saying is that we have to be able to take a look and do a personal inventory as to where our fears lie. So when we do something because we're afraid that if we don't do it, something will happen, or we won't be approved of, or we're doing it again out of fear or coming from lack, we put in tremendous pressure on ourselves. And when we do or accomplish things from a point of pressure rather than joy, we actually encourage our own personal depression. That's very interesting. Now, I want to talk to you about depression for a moment. Because what they're saying is that there's many people out there, especially in these times, that are going through a personal emotional depression. And that emotional depression can actually stop you from moving forward. And so this message here is for you to really look at the areas, again, they're talking about a personal inventory of your fears. And then they're talking about noticing how those fears have noticing how those fears are actually based in anger. So, for example, there's a fear about not having enough money, for example. Let's say you've just been laid off from your job, or you're worried about your job, or et cetera. So you allow the fear of being laid off or the fear of not having enough money, and that fear then turns to anger that you have to worry about it, and that anger is then turned inside because now you're angry at yourself for possibly, a lot of this has nothing to do with truth. It has everything to do with the way you're perceiving things. But you move into an anger itself because you are angry at yourself for, let's say, not doing well, and that's why you got laid off, which may have nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the economy. And then that anger itself moves into anger and helplessness around the society aspect, and that anger and helplessness then turns to depression. So we have to really be very vigilant as to how we allow ourselves or how we really look out at life, because that really moves us to a different place. So, in this time, that was a very interesting question about the population on the planet. You know, the idea here is that we need to walk forward knowing there is enough for everyone. And it has nothing to do whether there's enough money. It's not about money. Easy for me to say, huh? No, I'm going through the same thing you are. Believe me. I mean, it's all around. But we cannot we cannot be focused on not enough money. We have to be focused on the various areas of gratitude and the various areas of knowing we're okay. So as soon as fear hits, we have to stop for a moment and do our personal inventory and ask ourselves the very important question of, why do I absolutely know that I'm always taken care of? Why do I know I will always have enough money to take care of myself? Why do I absolutely know that everything will turn out all right? Why do I absolutely know there is enough for everyone on the planet? Why do I absolutely know that I am always enough? And so it's those questions that we must ask ourselves. It's not even about answering them. Notice I'm not saying, the record keepers are not saying answer. They're saying ask and allow the universe to answer the questions for you. It puts you in a different place. It puts you in a different state of mind, state of being, state of receiving. And so that's the place where we have to be. We have to be in the place of being willing to receive rather than in the space of the fear of lack of getting. It's real important. I'm going to say that again. We need to move ourselves into a place of being willing to receive rather than the fear of not getting. And so that, ladies and gentlemen, is a real important space. So I would love to have you call and comment on that or whatever else you'd like to comment on tonight. And again, I'm going to give you the number. If you're possibly on a stream and you don't have the BBS numbers there, you're listening to BBS Radio, by the way. This is BBS Internet Radio, and I am Donna Fox, and you're listening to Akashic Wisdom. And the telephone number to call in to be a part of this program, to lend your opinions or ask your questions, would be 888-815-9756, or if you would like to call in on a direct line, it's 530-876-3222. So, again, this show is as good as your calls, and we really want your calls and comments to come in. Interesting that people these days are so concerned about what their soul's purpose are. Of course, you've heard me say this before. We have another question, and I hope this gal is listening in. Her first name is Barbara, and the questions she's asking are questions that people all over the world want to understand. And the question is the general question here is, what is blocking me from having a healthy, loving relationship? What is blocking me from attracting a healthy, loving relationship? And then her other question is insight into the clarity of her life's purpose and what is holding her back from recognizing it. And so these are questions that the record keepers would like to speak to all of you about, because there is some general information here that's very important. One of the things that's important around attracting a healthy, loving relationship has to do with really being clear about who you are and what is important to you, and not being a chameleon in trying to be whatever the other person or whatever you think the other person wants. That's very important. Because when you are not true to yourself and you try to be what you think the other person wants, you're putting yourself in a position of stress. And notice, you're also coming from a place of lack. And that place of lack is a belief system that you're not enough. therefore you must manufacture or try to act like someone or something else that the other person wants. So I want you to just think about that. In other words, like, obviously there's somebody out there that this is meaningful for, because nothing comes through the records that is not meaningful for someone somewhere out there. That's always, the information comes forward in a very interesting way. And so there's someone out there, many people I'm thinking that could identify with that. So, and we have a caller. Hello, caller.
Hi, Donna.
Hi, who is this?
Tanya.
Hi, Tanya.
How are
What's
you?
What's up?
Pardon?
Where are you calling from?
Hope, British Columbia.
Oh, didn't you call last week?
I did.
Okay, great. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
And what's happening in your life these days? How can we help you?
My guys have been trying to connect with me through automatic writing, and I've been having troubles making that connection. I'm just wondering what's blocking me and what I can do to help it.
Okay, that's very interesting. Did you email me, by the way, Tanya?
I did.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was just trying to... here it is. Okay, I just wanted to get your... By the way, thank you, and I apologize for not emailing you back. I'm not going to read the whole thing right now, but I wanted to get your full name, and that's right there in your email address. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, so we want to understand, so when you sit down to write through automatic writing, what's happening?
Well, I just try and, clear my thought, clear my head, and sometimes I get, my body starts to wiggle a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I will get scribblings. Twice I've done it, I've got a lot of scribblings, and then SOS. And then other times, sometimes I just get absolutely nothing. But I've also been told that they're trying to connect with me at 11 a.m. and 11 p.m., so I've been trying at those times but not necessarily getting any further.
What is the purpose of their connecting with you as automatic writing? Have you asked them?
No, because I haven't really been able to, all I'm getting is scribblings and a couple of SOSs.
So what the record keepers want you to understand is that whenever you're working with your guidance or what you think is guidance, you really need, and you get that, the scribbling SOS business?
Yeah.
You really need to ask who that is.
Okay.
Okay? And notice how your body feels when that happens.
Okay.
Is it a good feeling?
It's not I wouldn't say a good or a bad.
Do you feel at all anxious?
Pardon me?
Are you feeling at all anxious?
Well, see, it's only happened a couple times, and it's been a while since it has, so I can't really, remember.
The reason they're saying that is that when you're talking about automatic writing, it's very important that you get clear about what your body's feeling.
Okay.
And to be aware of whether it feels good or it doesn't feel good.
Okay.
I'm just telling you what I'm hearing. What they're saying is that that when you're working with pure spirit, it always feels good.
Okay.
If for some reason it does not feel really good, then you need to ask who this is and bring light in.
Okay.
I'm not trying to scare you. That's not the issue.
Oh, no.
It's just an awareness, please, that they want you to understand that part of this block you think you have has, again, to do with you stepping into what you believe to be your greatness. Another part of it is that there are some times where guides can play games. Do you understand that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what you really, if you really want to get work done, you really have to say, I'm really not interested in playing games right now.
Okay.
Okay. And so it is that, and so you need to be very clear about who you're working with.
Okay.
And what their intention is. And why they choose 11 and 11 to work with you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, 11-11 is very nice. You know, that's a master number. But there's nothing wrong with questioning the why.
Yeah.
And there was like, when we're working with guides, we have to understand that they are, quite frankly, serving us. We are not serving them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the contract with our guidance to assist us in moving forward on whatever plan we set up prior to coming in.
Yeah.
And so it's very important when anyone is working with their guidance that they make sure that they're working with their guidance and not lower vibrational energies.
Okay.
And lower vibrational energies are identify themselves, or you can tell that they're is when they don't feel good.
Okay.
Okay. When you feel anxious, when your throat kind of gets tight, when you know it's and again, this is not being said to scare you or any of the listeners.
Yeah.
It's really more about be aware of who you're working with.
Yeah.
And make it clear when you start working that you move into such a sacred space that your intention is totally your intention and your auric field is filled with the intention of only contacting and working with divine love.
Yes.
And so it's really important that you put that out there, or and again, whoever else is listening that wants to work, that they want to work with the highest level of their I Am presence, they want to work with the highest level of Divine Creator, but whatever is light and white and of the highest is what you want to work with.
Okay.
And the other piece here is, what is your connection with Mother Mary?
I'm not exactly sure because all this, I don't know how, I can't remember how much I explained in my email to you, but this life that I'm living has just come about since about the end of September last year. Like, I didn't even go to church or anything like that. I'm not sure what my connection is.
Well, and again, this is not a religious connection.
Yeah.
I understand today is a very special day for many people, but the idea is your connection with Mother Mary has more to do with your connection with the earth and her nurturing of the earth.
Okay.
So I don't know what that is, but the record keepers wanted to help you become aware that there is a connection with Mother Mary.
Okay.
More from a nurturing mother point of view.
Yeah.
Of healing issues with the mother or healing issues with your mother.
Ah.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And so the issues here of you working with your mother or working with the healing of the issues with your mother has to do with really moving into the compassion of being willing to be open with yourself and not listening to the essence of what of your relationship with your mother.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. Kind of took a little while to get there, but you got it, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea here is it's really about it's about moving into forgiveness, compassion, and releasing old beliefs that block you based on fear and lack of stepping into your power.
Yeah.
Based on your relationship with your mother.
Yeah. It's funny because I've been thinking of that a lot, and my mom doesn't really know how to even communicate. So I'm like, how am I supposed to explain all this to her? And, you know, and I thought maybe I'll just send her a letter and a card because it might be too much for her to do it on like a face-to-face sort of thing.
Why do you have to?
Why do I have to, which?
Communicate with her if you don't want to.
Oh, no, I want to communicate with her. I want to do it, but she's not much of a communicator.
No, but the issue is that she doesn't need to understand.
Okay.
In other words, like, many times people want to get things straight with another person that has no capacity to understand where they're coming from.
Right.
And all it does is by the need to explain has less to do with wanting the other person to understand and more to do with the person wanting that other person's approval.
Okay.
So the issue here is it has nothing to do with her understanding you as it does with you just being willing to love her for who she is.
Right. And to give forgiveness.
Exactly.
Okay.
And to receive forgiveness of self.
Yeah.
You see, you know, many people don't understand what's happening with light workers because that's not their path.
Yeah.
It's not about whether they have the capacity or not. That's just not their choice for this lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all light beings. Right?
Yeah.
So it's really more about you being willing to receive and explain, accept her for who she is and model that.
Mm-hmm.
For her, without even expectation that she will do that for you.
Right.
And then it's also about you moving into your higher self and your little kid inside and accepting that little one inside that she didn't. Does that make sense?
Sorry, I just missed that last couple of words there. I don't know if something happened over the line or...
I said what happened is it's important that you move into your higher self and your little kid within you and do the work you need to accept her the way your mother didn't accept you.
Right, yeah.
There was like there's a lack of acknowledgement here. Because your mom is not a good communicator, there's a lack of this of acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Within you. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And that lack of acknowledgement also has to do with the fear of being wrong.
Right.
And that fear of being wrong is part of what's blocking you from receiving what you need to receive.
Yep, that totally makes sense.
I went around the mulberry bush on that.
But you have a fear of being wrong. Even at 5 years old or, you know, 6 years old being in school, I had a fear. I would never put my hand up because I thought, well, what if I was wrong?
Right.
So I never put my hand up to try and ask.
Well, sure. So then how can you possibly be okay to write something for fear somebody's not going to like it?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why the forgiveness with the mother is going to be important.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot about self-nurturing and you helping yourself to move into a space of light.
Yeah. Great.
Kind of goes around, and there was like, most of this, though, Tanya, has to do with you trusting.
Okay. Myself?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the process.
Yeah.
And allowing yourself to not know.
Okay.
You know, many times you can't figure everything out.
Right.
First, I'm going to just bring you back to the beginning of the show. I had no idea what I was talking about. Half the time I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Right.
I forget what I say. This show will be done, and somebody will call me, and they'll say, that was a great show. I loved what you said. And I'll say, what was it?
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm not conscious. My eyes are wide open. I'm in full personality.
Yeah.
But I trust the process to such a point that I move over. And that's why when I do a consultation with someone, very similar to what I'm doing with you,
yeah,
I move over, check in with them, because I have no reference in many cases. So I have to say, does that make sense to you?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's about trusting the process. In order to be able to go as deep as you can,
yeah,
you have to be willing not to know why you're saying what you're saying.
Okay.
And you have to be willing to just allow it.
And trust it.
And trust it. And then if you write it, okay,
yeah,
then you read back and you say, does this ring true or does it not?
Yeah.
And, you know, you'll know right away. It'll either be right or it won't.
Yeah.
And it's not about being right, rather. It'll feel good. Remember the feel good part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Was this helpful?
Well, thank you, Donna. That was very helpful.
Good, good. I'm so glad you called in.
Yes, me too. I'm going to keep on listening to your show. I love it.
All right. Well, I'm glad. Tell your friends.
I will.
Okay, dear.
Thank you. Right,
take care.
You too.
Bye, Tanya.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So, you know, folks, that's so important. You know, did you notice how we just kind of did a little circle dance here? We went round and around until we got to the core. So we go round and around and get until we get to the core. And that's what this is all about. That's what this is all about. And that's also what you're all about. I mean, how many times do you do the dance until you figure out what's going on? Huh. So now the record keepers I have to talk to you a little bit about the resurrection of the day today. When we talk about, and again, this is not a religious commentary. This is a spiritual commentary around the meaning of the day from a symbolic point of view. So if you consider that there is a day where a being of light that has been documented came to Earth, and the story, again, this is not saying that the story is true, that the story is not true, that there is Jesus, there isn't Jesus. You know, clearly we understand about the Christed Spirit, but the reality is that we have to look at the day of being resurrected and moving to a higher level. So I would like you to consider, what the record keepers are suggesting you consider, is how can you be resurrected to a higher level of being? And what does being resurrected to a higher level of being mean for you? What does it mean to have a part of you go away or die and a new part of you be resurrected to a higher level of being? And that's very important. So if you were to do anything this week, it would be to look at the various ways your life has been resurrected to a higher level of being based on the experiences you're having. And notice how the old you or old ways die and new ways and new information are resurrected for you. That's what would be important for you to note. So how does being, again, they're talking about, how is being resurrected in the spirit, how does that affect you? How does that look, what does that look like in your life? So, just want to take a moment and encourage you to move into that space of light, to pull your awareness up a little higher and take an overview of the day's activities for yourself, or this past week's activities, or the way your life is and the way you would like it to be. Pull yourself up to a higher level of being and observe what you feel is working and what you feel is not working. And when you observe what you think is not working, make a choice about what you're willing to do to shift that outcome. Notice you don't have to do anything. Just be aware of what it is that you don't care for. And the same thing, notice what you do like. Notice how, the good feeling that gives you, and be appreciative of that. Notice that. You have to take time now to I want you to think about that. Before we go, I want to point you in a couple of directions. Number one, I want you to point you into the direction of if you're planning on doing any travel. I'm told that I have lifepathtravel.com. That's L-I-F-E travel, lifepath, L-I-F-E-P-A-T-H, lifepathtravel.com. If you need tickets, if you need event information, if you need to send flowers, if you need for Mother's Day, if you're going to be traveling to visit your mother, we were talking about moms, now's the time to book your travel on lifepathtravel.com. Great prices, very competitive prices, and check out the site because there's lots of things you can do with it. You can even send, like I said, flowers to your mother on that day, on Mother's Day. It's not too early to start thinking about that, you know, especially if you're planning on traveling. So Life Path Travel is the way to go. Also, I need to tell you that my classes have shifted, and for those people who were thinking, I have to shift the classes. And so here's the way the classes are going to work. The classes are going to be on prosperity marketing is going to be on May 2nd and 3rd, and the level 1 Akashic Records workshop is going to be on May 9th and 10th. I know that's Mother's Day, but that's when it's going to be, on May 9th and 10th. So give a call if that's of interest to you. So now you have some extra time and plenty of time to get those airline tickets through Life Path Travel. Again, Prosperity Marketing is going to be on May 2nd and 3rd, and Level 1 on May 9th and 10th. Okay, we're almost 5 minutes to the hour. It's 11:52 here in Cleveland. So if you're going to call, this would be the time. Don't wait any longer. But I want to get back to that question that we were talking about life purpose and what we were talking about, what was holding back. I think we kind of answered that before. And loving relationships. We were talking about loving relationships right before Tanya called. And I think, did we complete that? Let me see. I don't know if that's ever completed. You know, loving relationships that we're just not sure about. Oh, we were talking about being a chameleon. I see, that's right. And so it's really about us being clear about who we want to be and being that person and looking for the person that would not fulfill our dreams so much as that we would feel joyful around being. we would feel joyful by being with that person rather than needing the person. It's really not about needing someone as so much as being joyful that we're with that person. So, here's what we're going to do. It's now almost, let's see, what time is it? It's 11:54. Oh, we have a caller. I was about to sign off. You got in right at the line. Okay, great. Who's this?
Hi, it's Rebecca.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you calling from?
From California.
Okay. Have you called before?
Yeah, I have. I talked to you a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. How's your life?
It's great. I have one question.
Okay.
What do the records say about employment for me, financial stuff? I've been dealing with this for quite a few years, and I know it's up for a lot of people right now. And is there a special lesson that I need to get out of it?
How long have you been out of work?
Well, I'm having a contract come to an end. So I've worked for a year, but before that I hadn't worked for several years.
What's the industry?
Software.
Okay. Well, again, we're not going to do future so much as what part of this do you, what I'm getting something around here, Rebecca, has more to do with your desire for independence than your, it's very interesting. It's almost like you want to be independent and you want to be employed.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Do you understand that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the idea of wanting independence, so you're sending out, you're sending out conflicting messages to the universe.
Okay.
So one of the questions you make in your morning meditations or whatever you do that is that it's really about you getting clear about the essences of the employment that you want. Have you done that?
What does essences mean?
It means, so for example, the type of employment you want is to work for a company having a total level of autonomy.
Me or the company?
No, you have the autonomy to do what you need to do in the company.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, total autonomy, all right, being well paid for your talents.
Yeah.
And appreciated for your talents. And in an environment that encourages creativity.
Okay.
That allows flexibility.
Okay.
And offers me the chance to grow as a human being.
Okay.
And a productive employee.
Okay.
And then fill in the blanks with whatever else you like. So I want to work for a company with all that. I mean, are those things that were just mentioned for you important for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. It's like this is a dream job title, so to speak.
What just was described to you, you mean?
Yeah, it would be great as a, you know, a job description kind of thing.
Great. So in claiming that, it's not like notice that when you said that, what I'm hearing is, if only it were true.
Right, okay.
Notice the underlying belief that it can't happen.
Okay.
Do you get that?
Yes, I do.
And because it was a definite energy there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you really need to really dissolve and neutralize the energy of doubt. And claim that this is what I want. This is the environment that I choose to work in.
Okay.
Which is different. It's a different energy.
Okay. Okay, got it. Excuse me.
Okay.
Work with.
Is that helpful?
Thank you so much, yes.
Okay, we have a good week.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye, Donna.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, so did everybody get that? I hope you really got that. That was a great description. I mean, it might not fit everyone out there, but it sure would fit a lot of us. And so the idea here is to really get clear. If you're looking for work, or you want to change jobs, or if you've been laid off and you want another job, please don't come from lack. Please don't come from, wouldn't it be nice if I could get? No. Draw it out. What do you want? Become empowered. This is your life. Don't walk around with your tail between your legs being meek. That's just not allowed. You're better than that. It's about really deciding what it is you want to claim. And then noticing if there's doubts within you, and it's what I was saying before, it's about learning how to neutralize it and eliminate them. And if you're having problems neutralizing and eliminating them, then I suggest you call me privately. So if you want to call me offline to schedule a consultation, I'm happy to do that for you. My telephone number is 216-691-1233. And I'd be happy to email you information about consultations at info. Just all you have to do is email me and say, I want information on consultations. info@akashicwisdom.com. We can get at the bottom of what's going on for you. I can help you understand what your core issues are and how to neutralize them. So if that's of importance to you, give me a call. Don't wait. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. So I want to thank you all for listening. I want you to have a wonderful, miracle-filled week. Know that you are as magnificent as you allow yourself to be.